Welcome to the second day in Venerable Robina's weekend workshop on how to enjoy death. I think everybody in here is familiar with who she is, so I won't give you her bio. Just a quick reminder that when she enters the room, we all stand out of respect for the teachings that she holds. She will prostrate to the altar, and then those of us, when she's seated, those of us who wish to will prostrate toward her. That's a little different from how we do things with Geshe Gelug, but that's more the traditional way. And if you're not comfortable with prostrations, you can just take a seat. Venerable Robina will be leading a couple of spiritual retreats and pilgrimages in Asia later this year. In June, she'll lead a retreat at Borobudur, a 9th century Buddhist temple in Indonesia. And in October and November, she'll be leading a about a 4-week pilgrimage in India and Nepal, where you visit quite a few Buddhist holy sites, including the places where the Buddha was born, where he was enlightened, where he gave the teaching on emptiness. And it's quite an amazing experience. If you're interested in it, there are postcards out across from the bookstore and a little sign-up sheet where you can sign up to get information. Also, the email for that is on the back of the postcard. We have course notes here, Venerable Robina is teaching from these. We have them available in the bookstore. We're asking a donation of about $10 to cover our cost of getting them printed. If you would like to have this and you just can't stretch to that cost, we have had someone who has offered to sponsor those for you. So if you would like to have one and you just can't stretch to pay for one, then go ahead and go to the bookstore and we have a sponsor who'll cover that for you. Venerable Robina will speak for a while and then she opens the floor up to questions. If you do ask a question, wait for someone to give you a microphone and you'll want to hold it close to your mouth so it can be heard. This is because we are streaming online and we also record the teaching. So if you don't use the microphone, your contribution is lost. Don't forget to mute your phones. And then the last thing is that Kadampa Center has a long tradition of offering the teachings at no charge. We never want money to be an obstacle for anyone to hear these amazing and precious teachings, but we do have expenses, so we would welcome any donations you are moved to give. We have a donation box. I was doing that with the mic. We have a donation box right outside the Gampa. We have one right inside the door on Jill's desk, and the bookstore can also accept credit cards. Thank you.
I see you all? Sort of. Okay. All right.
Yep, good.
So we think. I'm here to listen to these ideas, these viewpoints, these explanations coming from the experiences of the great yogis about death, about what happens after death, about how to prepare for death, and indeed what happens after death, but preparing for that. But then crucially, on the basis of this, knowing how ourselves how to die well, so we can plan our future. Because Buddha would say that another life is what happens. So that we can also then help others. So this is on the basis of a book of Lamas Over Rinpoche's published by Wisdom called How to Enjoy Death. But the whole way it's all framed is how to help your loved ones, you know? Because you have to sort of address the book to somebody. You can't address it to you to what to do when your breath stops. That'd be quite complicated, wouldn't it? When your breath stops, do that. It's not going to work. So you have to address it to how to help other people when their breath stops. But the implication is you learn to know yourself how to die and what's important. So we're going to listen to all this, either as Buddhists who are taking all this as our hypothesis or as interested people. So that doesn't mean you believe it all. You just simply listen to it and take the advice that makes sense to you. You can be a devoted Christian and much of this can be very helpful. You can say that. And the reason we're doing this is so that we can learn to live our lives better, can learn to die well, can learn therefore to help others. That's the bottom line. So we use that as our reasoning for being here listening. So we can develop our qualities, so we can help others. And that in the Buddhist view means develop ourselves all the way to Buddhahood, to perfection. So we'll be effortlessly capable of helping others. That's the long-term goal. Okay, we'll sing a little prayer. The second two lines of which express that, sort of. The first two lines of which are just reiterating for those of us who are Buddhists, reliance upon the Buddha and his teachings and so on and so forth.
Sangye charang soke chognam la jang cho badu dagni khyab su chi dagi chanyen gi pe sonam ki drola penche sangye drupa shok Sangye charang soke chognam la jang cho badu dagni khyab su chi dagi chanyen gi pe sonam ki drola penche sangye drupa shok Sangye charang soke chognam la changcho badu dagni khyab su chi dagi chanyen gi pe sonam ki drola penche sangye drupa shok.
So there's various components to this, to what we're going to discuss. One is really is, you know, starting at this moment, how do we prepare for death? And of course the answer to that's pretty simple. You live your life a certain way. So when we say preparing for death, it's kind of a huge one, you know. If you're a materialist, it sounds rather peculiar, and mostly it would seem like you've got to prepare your will and prepare your coffin and prepare the church service once you're gone, because you're not interested in after, because you're a materialist and you think you disappear into nothing. So then preparing for death is kind of a weird one, and generally speaking we don't like to think about that, and we can't see any reason for it, you know, except to write our will and maybe have a say. Maybe write our will is the most people could do, you know. But if you know you're dying, then you like to think about the coffin, what it looks like. You like people organize their church service and that kind of thing, you know. Nothing wrong. But the materialist point of view, the final point is death. So it's preparing for death. But, you know, as I mentioned, I happen to be the one who edited this book, had to put it together. So it was a very helpful experience for me doing it, of course, being a Buddhist. This has, you know, enriched my own understanding of things. When you edit something, you've got to be very clear about it. What became clear for my mind, which if we think about it from the Buddhist perspective is really obvious, but it doesn't hit us really, is you're not preparing for death. You're preparing for the next life. Now that's exactly how a Christian would talk. You know, same thing. Because we, you know, there are some things similar, as we can see. If you're a Christian, you believe in God, and you believe if you're good, you'll be rewarded, and you'll be with him in heaven with God. So you're preparing for the next life. That's how they call it, the next life. Buddhism would say the next life also. But as we all know, Buddha's view is very different. The next life could be a dog. The next life could be human, you know, because Buddha has this view, which is part of the whole deal, Buddhist philosophy. Buddhist take on the universe, that our consciousness, like we've been talking, is a beginningless and endless continuity of mental moments, and that's programmed by how we think and act and speak every second, which is the law of karma, and that we produce our own experiences. We're not punished or rewarded. So in this sense, as we've been discussing, is a massive difference. And we'll go into this, we'll talk about this, we must, because this is a crucial part of the whole process of how you prepare for death and the next life. So that has to start now, not just wait until you die. You know, you many, and that's a very common one in the West. And in fact, even many materialists will go, well, I hope I die during my sleep, but I won't know about it. You know? Of course, if you do turn into dust, then that makes complete sense. Who would want to know about it, and why would you bother to prepare? You clearly, if you're gonna fall into a black hole and disappear, then there's no reason to prepare. I completely agree with you. And it's best to do it when you don't know. Let it come along and take you while you're not looking, you know? Much better. I agree, totally. But clearly that's not the Buddha's view. And indeed it wouldn't be the Christian view either. So the Buddha's view is, you know, if we take the bigger picture point of view, which is the, you know, the framework for all the teachings in this book and this discussion we're going to have here, is because Buddha doesn't assert a creator, therefore there's no punishment and reward, therefore there's no someone running the show, therefore it's not a question of being a good girl and hoping that someone sees it and rewards you with a nice future life. It's not a question of that. You're the boss. You have to be in touch with it. You have to be prepared for it. You're the one who has to plan it, organize it. And I really mean it when I say simple things like, if you say you want to go on a vacation next year to Australia, you know very well, you just don't go, oh, I hope I get to Australia, or I wish I could go to Australia, or please can I get to Australia, or I wish I could go to Australia, or may I go to Australia, and then hope it comes. We know things don't work like that. The first step is, may I go to Australia? Then from there on, you're the planner. You organise. You put the piece of time in, you find the means, you buy the tickets, you pack your bags, and then you climb on the aeroplane, just as you planned. We all know that. That's called life. We understand this, and we are geniuses at it. So a really simple way to put this for a Buddhist is just factor in one more stop, you know, called next human birth. It's going to be vacation, retirement, holiday, Bali, next life. Just plug it into your schedule. Next life to the end. And you're not sure what it's going to be, you know. It could be next week, as we discussed yesterday. It sounds so hilarious to us. But it's, why not? You know, why not? And so as Rinpoche says, you know, and this is again the point, as Rinpoche says, helping our loved ones at the time of death is the best service we can offer them, our greatest gift. Why? Because death is the most important time of life. Which is a shock if you're a materialist, that's totally depressing. Because for the Buddhists, it's at death that the next rebirth is determined. You know, we discussed this a bit last night, and we're going to go into the details of these things now. So what we're going to do over the weekend is talk about, one, the whole approach during our life, so you are prepared, and then second, because of that you're prepared to help others, and then the actual details about, you know, the book is broken down into, when it gets to the point about helping others, what to do during the weeks and months before death, months and weeks before death, what to do as the death process begins. We'll discuss the death process itself as it's described, you know, in very great detail. What to do when the breath stops, exactly what to do. What to do the moment after the breath, what to do the 3 days after, what to do if your loved one dies at home, what to do if your loved one dies suddenly, what to do if your loved one gives their organs, what to do if your loved one is a meditator, what to do after the mind leaves the body, and then what to do the next 49 days, the next 7 weeks. So it's not just at the end of death, which of course if you're a materialist it would be that, but it's a lot to do after that as well from the Buddhist perspective. So in the book itself, the first 150 or something pages are these teachings, and the last 350 or 300 are the actual practices that Lama Zopa Rinpoche recommends. They're the actual formal type practices, prayers and mantras and this one and that puja and that sutra and that thing to do, because he recommends masses of things, which sometimes is why it's also overwhelming, you know. So this is like a handbook and it's structured chronologically, which makes it more helpful. And the fact is, he recommends millions of things, because it's his book, he's allowed to, and most of us won't do 99% of them. So in terms of formal practices, you know, Rinpoche always comes down to it, if you're going to do anything at all, medicine Buddha, good enough, amazing, one thing, medicine Buddha, you know, the practice, or even just simply the mantra. But there's like, you know, 80 other things you could do. And he's into these things. He's like, he loves all these practices. He finds mantras and practices no one else has ever heard of. So they're all there because they need to be there, but we might not use those, and that's just totally fine. So the key point, that we discussed it last night, but I'll say it here, the essential point, and then we'll look into the other points. The essential point, the crucial point, from the Buddhist perspective, it's not even just vaguely, oh, I'll help my grandmother during the death process. If you're going to have to choose, and this is what makes it difficult, because we don't know when someone's going to die, sometimes people can see, nurses and doctors seem to be pretty good at this, they say, oh, she's got a few hours, you know, or something. They can predict a little bit. So the crucial time, if you have to sort of slot in a period when you want to help your mummy, when you want to be with your little dog when she dies, and this is your animals as well, exactly the same, it's in that period before they stop breathing. Days and hours better be, not just a minute, you know. Because why? It's a technical point in Buddhism. We're going to go into this. The process of death, what occurs at the time of death, how the death process happens, and when the mind leaves the body, all these things. And in Buddhism, as we know, they're quite articulate about this. Quite interesting, quite helpful. And I think many people who aren't Buddhist find this also very helpful. They kind of trust this one, you know. Things to do to help your loved one. And the crucial point is to help them do what? The essence of it, we mentioned last night, the absolute essence of it is to help them to be two things, peaceful and virtuous. So virtuous means, don't get the things all holy. Your mind is virtuous when you're loving, when you're generous, when you're thinking positive thoughts. That's what virtue means. It doesn't mean religion, it just means morality. You know, you self-check with yourself when you're feeling compassionate, when you're feeling loving, when you're feeling forgiving, when you control your mouth and don't say that bad word, when you smile at somebody. That's what virtue means. So when the mind, you all know, when your mind feels like this, this is something natural. When your mind is more involved with those things, you're also, your mind is peaceful. But when there's anger, when there's fear, when there's distress, when you're tormented, when there's jealousy, when there's grasping and attachment, and this is especially at the time of death. I mean, the unique level of attachment at death is just stupendous. When the mind's like this, you're completely distressed, completely disturbed, and necessarily, in Buddhist psychology, that is what triggers ego and panic and ego and therefore so-called non-virtue. You know, negative, unhappy, distressful states of mind. And the point even about this, why you even want to be peaceful and virtuous, not just because it looks nice. No, it's got a really technical meaning, because in this process of death, which we're going to describe, the karmic seeds that will be the one, that will be the cause of your next life, that determines your next life, that's triggered in that period before you stop breathing. So it's like, when, you know, I'm going to help my mother cross the road. Well, when, you know? When all the traffic's coming. That's when she needs you most. That period is when she needs you most. If there's no traffic, she's cool. She can handle it. So it's a technical point, not some emotional thing. Oh, you be with your loved one when they die, you know? It's technical. And the reason to be there this is another point. Someone who saw this manuscript when we were working on it, she said, where's the chapter about grief? Well, this book is not about us. It's not about the helpers. That's another discussion. The book's about the person dying. Everything in this book is to help us help the person who dies to get a better life. That's the point. That's the point from the Buddhist point of view. That's the essence of it. That's the purpose of it. So it's marvelous if all the loved ones are around, and it's marvelous if your mummy's there and you're loving her, you know, and she's forgiving you and everything's loving, and then she stops breathing. Then for us, it's all about us. In the materialist world, obviously you don't do more because you don't talk about those things. If you're a Christian, you'd do more. Fine. And certainly the Buddhist point isn't about us. In fact, everything, getting the room ready, having the ideal scenario, knowing what to do, how to do, everything is in order to help the person who's dying. You know, and the people who are the people who help the person, everything that goes on in that room, everything that's in that room, whoever walks into the room, whatever's done in that room, or that ward, or that cubicle, has to be for the benefit of the person in the bed. It's very clear, you know. And once we understand this, as Rinpoche says, once we have this education, and he says everybody needs this education, not just, you know, people who work in hospices and hospitals, because everyone, someone's going to die, everybody will have somebody who dies, and we want to know how to help. Even our pets, one of the most distressing things for most people, their beloved pets, they don't know what to do. Is it best to go to the vet? Is it best to put them down? Is it best to do this? Is it best to do that? We want to have some advice so we can think about it and make wise choices, you know. So we want to know these things. This is what I'm recommending to Donna, you know, USP, the program coordinator here, you should work with the people, work with the nuns and come up with, construct little courses based on this and have regular courses about how to help your pets die, how to help you, you know, people love this information. We need this kind of advice, you know. Because we want to be helpful. Many people have such guilt about the way their animals have died, so years later in tears because they had to have the vet kill it. What could I have done? What should I do? Same with our grandmas. How to make decisions? What's the basis for what decision you make? Everybody is confused. You know? And we have to know. So of course we're not Buddhists. It's not your business. You know, don't take notice of Buddhists. This is for people who take the Buddhist teachings, who take this as their basis, you know. Or even people who might be Christian but sort of respect these opinions, you know. It's kind of so helpful, so important. And as I said also last night, I mean, I've been a Buddhist quite a while, and you think, oh yeah, I know all about this, oh yeah, I know the death process, oh yeah, I know this, I know that. But you know what happens when the death comes, because you're not really educated, you panic. Everyone panics, you know. Not sure if you're doing the right thing. Not sure, should I do this, should I do that? How do I know when the mind has left? When should I move the body? These practical things. We need to have confidence, you know. So we'll discuss all this. So we mentioned last night, you know, the first start, the first point to start is in life, this moment, starting now. Thinking about the utter inevitability of death. And not just thinking about, oh, death is definite. You know, like the first point of the three points we discussed yesterday, a basic practice for a Buddhist, is to start to get in touch with the fact of impermanence. But in particular, the fact of the impermanence of my death. Not to make us scared. It's like to give us a wake-up call. It's got some logic to it, you know. Remember that we said last night, the first point. But death is definite. Then we hear we should meditate on these things, and we get confused. We don't know, because we have a different, we have a weird idea of what we think meditation means. And then we hear we're supposed to meditate on death. We don't know what it means, because we've got a weird view of what the word meditate means. But when we understand the word meditate in Tibetan, it's very interesting. The word meditate is a verb to familiarize. Which means to think about it. Nothing more or less. We know we have this term analytical meditation. Well, it's just a medieval phrase, a fancy term for to think about it. Truly, analytical meditation means to think about it. But not in the way we tend to think about things, which is all over the place, you know. Vaguely and emotionally and fantasies and dramas and forgetting what we're doing, but in a really clear, rigorous way, like we would when we learn things. And that's what analytical meditation is. You know, when you learn something at school, your teacher says, go and do your homework. What she would say, if she was using Tibetan language, she'd say, go and do some analytical meditation on this, Rabina. And that what that hears to a Buddhist ear, if you know the meaning of the word in Tibetan, means go and do some clear, intelligent thinking about this in order to trigger the answer, in order to get an insight into it. That's literally what this means. But because it sounds like spiritual, we put it in the sky somewhere, mystified, and get confused, you know. So as we know in Buddhism, there's two main kinds of meditation. The first one, which is crucial, so you train your mind to be focused. And with a focused mind, you then can do the second mode, which is the goal of which is to get an insight, is to realize something, is to have the penny drop, whether it's mathematics, violin, or Buddhahood, or karma, or whatever the points are, here in this case, impermanence. You have a focused mind, and then you think about it. So how would you think about the first point, death is definite? You just don't go, death is definite, death is definite, death is definite, death is definite, waiting for something to happen. That's superstitious. You use ordinary life experiences, and you observe your daily life, you observe the news you read, the things you see, the ant that's dead, the dog that's dead, the mummy that's dead, the friend that's dead, and you go, you know, and you recognize slowly, you take this information, which is staring us in our face, but which we never process properly, because like we talked last night, we are living in denial of death. We can't bear to think about death. So as long as death is out there somewhere, you feel safe from it. Oh yeah, death, oh, but it's over there. Like I said, there's this hubris we have, it's not me. I'm still okay, I'm a living person, I'm alright, I'm cool. So it never touches. But what Buddha wants us to do, what in this practice, what Atisha, what Tsongkhapa wants us to do, is get the wake-up call. So you go, that'll happen to me, that'll be me one day. You see that little dog suddenly dies, got a shock of his life, he felt like a living person just like we did, and boom, he's dead. Big surprise. You go, that'll be me. Then that's the insight. Then you think, okay, then what? So then that'll be me. What am I supposed to think now? Well, next one is you even increase that wish, you increase that sense of urgency, increase that sense, that recognition that I am indeed impermanent, even more, like I said last night, it should scare the life out of us, correctly. I have no idea, though, when I'm going to die. So we really have to get the wake-up call. In other words, to start to get this feeling, to start to get a feeling of the truth that I am an impermanent person. I'm a highly dynamic bunch of pieces come together and there's nothing permanent about it. Highly fragile, if you see how easy it is to die. And you die at any moment. You don't have to be old to die. You don't have to be sick to die. You can be happy and young and a living person and you can still die. That's the proof of the world, although we can't bear to look at it because we don't want to know about it. So this type of all this thinking is trying to learn to break down these misconceptions in our mind. As we know very well from Buddha's teachings, one of his main ways of looking at the world, looking at us, sentient beings, looking at suffering, is we suffer because we have misconceptions in the mind, deeply ingrained that we believe is truth. So even though intellectually we know we are impermanent, emotionally we live in denial of it. We can't bear the thought of it. You know, the feeling we have is impermanent. The feeling that we have is very deep inside us. We have to analyze and look at this and start to shake this. And then why? Well, the third point is the point. Because as we said yesterday, and this is crucial, this is a point. These two other points lead to this one, the action point. And this is the basis of what we're going to now discuss, the Buddha's view. Remember, like I said last night, given, a series of givens, that according to the Buddha's view, which if we're Buddhist, we're taking it as a hypothesis, that's how I like to say it. Because you can't prove it immediately, it's too subtle. And just blindly believing it's not helpful. So for me, taking it as my working hypothesis is the best way to put it for my mind. I'm taking them as my hypothesis, the given that the Buddha's view is that my consciousness, this river of mental moments, this non-physical part of me, which is my thoughts, feelings, emotions, unconscious, subconscious, instinct, intuition, this entire spectrum of my inner being, this is known as mind or consciousness in Buddhism. Not discussing the brain or the body. That this continuity of mental moments, if you track yourself back perfectly in an unbroken chain of mental moments, there wouldn't be any bits missing. Every millisecond leads to the previous moment and the previous moment. We don't remember 90% of them, that's all. You know that's true though, and then you get back to where? The first moment in your mummy's womb. So the crucial question then, of course, from the Buddhist perspective is, you know, the moment before conception, what was happening? Well, the egg was in mummy's body, the sperm was in daddy's body, and where was your mind? Well, it's the same continuity. At a subtle level, you track it back to a previous moment of itself. And a few weeks before that, you're in another person, you're in a previous body. And before that, a previous body. Before that. This is just the Buddha's view. It's his observation. This is the Buddha's philosophical view of the universe. All sentient beings, all ants and dogs and humans and other beings we can't see, and there are trillions of them. This is how it is, Buddha says. This continuity is, these rivers of mental moments, or they call it the mental continuum. This is fundamental in Buddhism. And all the process of death and living are based upon this view. So given that it's a beginningless and endless, because when it leaves the body, it will continue. It does not, you just don't fall into a black hole and disappear. It'll continue. This is Buddha's view. So given that, then given more precisely, and this is the crucial point now, given according to the whole Buddhist observation about this law of karma, which we have to talk about to really understand how to prepare for death, and the role this plays at the time of death, it's really part of the deal. We must understand this. But every millisecond of what we think and do and say basically programs our consciousness. Every millisecond programs. Or, as they say, put seeds into the mind. And those seeds, unless you pull them out, will necessarily stay there and they'll start to grow because there's energy and energy expands. And eventually those seeds will ripen in the future as our experiences. As the Dalai Lama says, it's like you can call this self-creation. You know, we're not some entity that's produced by a superior being who then rewards or judges us, speaking simply. Not like that. Nor are we the handiwork of mummy and daddy, which means merely physical, and you fall into a black hole at the end. Neither of those is Buddha's view. So it's hugely different in this sense. We are the product of our own past handiwork. We are the creators of ourselves, and there's a literal way to put it. Not like a magic wand creation, in an evolutionary sense. In really the same way that you know if you are a good musician, you created yourself. You need a decent piano. You need a good teacher. But you did the work. You did the work. You're the boss. You made yourself a musician. That's karma. You look at your own tendency to be good. Guess why? Because you've been good before. You see your tendency to be angry. That's why? Because you did it before. You see yourself play piano well. Why? Because you played piano before. It's the same logic in Buddhism. Not some separate thing, intellectual and then emotional. It's all the same. It's our own tendencies. We are the producers of this. So we're the boss. So give it even more precisely now. This is the point. That every millisecond of what's labelled a negative action, and we need to understand this meaning, not some moralistic idea, we discussed last week, but we'll touch on it again. Every millisecond of what's labelled a negative action will necessarily, because it's a natural law, Buddha says, this is not judgment and punishment and reward, there's no concept in Buddhism like that, because there's no punisher and rewarder. This is a huge point, because we're very addicted to that view. But a negative action will necessarily ripen as suffering in that mental continuum, which happens to be labelled called me, whether it's in a dog's body or a human body. The producer of that is the seeds that were planted in that mind down back before. And that whatever is called a positive seed from a positive action will necessarily ripen as my happiness. So given finally the no-brainer, hey, I want happiness and I do not want suffering, then it follows logically So I need to train my mind to stop creating more negative actions and start producing positive ones. And don't hear this in that heavy moralistic way we are so used to it. Not like that. This is like learning to be good at eating, you know, learning nutrition. Why? For your sake. Everyone understands that. We understand it. It's not moralistic, it's practical. Well, the same issue. This is a Buddhist view, it's practical. So if this is on the basis of my being impermanent, on the basis of the fact that I will die at any moment, and on the basis of the fact that when I do die, this is the point, the third point, then obviously what the only thing that's any use to me, the only thing that I want to bring with me, the only thing is the positive seeds that I have planted in my mind from my positive actions throughout my life. That's the basis of morality in Buddhism. And this is all just for your own sake. It's nothing to do with compassion yet. It's practical, you know. Because just like with good food, your health is the product of your hard work. Same here. Your happiness is the product of your hard work. That's the Buddha's view. So we're the boss. We're in charge. And because, if we take the Buddha's view, and this is the point now, because my consciousness will continue, and that crucially, at the time of death, before I stop breathing, the seed that will be the one that will program my mind, or in our case, from our past life, okay? Just a few weeks before our past life. So maybe we can go into the death process even now. And we can talk about these things in different times, you know. Not more than a few weeks before, we, at the time of conception in our mother's womb, which generally speaking is when the egg and sperm come together. That's conception. A few weeks before that, you know, like I just, you know, I use my own self as an example. I just think about it. You know, I was born in December 1944. I came out when I was 7 months, apparently, so that's, you know, 7 months before. That's about May. So we can imagine there's mummy and daddy, my mummy and my daddy hopping into bed, or wherever they hopped. You know, who knows? A few weeks before that, before they hopped into bed, I was this consciousness, a continuity of this consciousness, which we label Rabinas now, but indeed at a subtle level, and we're going to go into this, was in another body. And before we stopped breathing, in that body, and as Lama Zopa says, it could have been a dog's body, it could have been an elephant, it could have been a worm, you know, it could have been a human. Before the life left the body, before the mind left, obviously before the mind ceased, before the gross consciousness ceased. Let's just assume we were human, okay? Before the gross consciousness ceased, we could deduce that some virtue was triggered, you know. And we have to even to understand this process, we've got to understand a little bit about karma, which we'll talk about. So remembering, from the Buddhist point of view, every millisecond of what we think, do, say, hear, smell, taste, touch, whatever our consciousness experiences, a trillion things a day, whatever that triggers in our mind gets stored in our consciousness, and we're not talking the brain here. Which is a difficult point for us if we think it's the brain. It's a whole other discussion here. A whole other view, you know. There's nothing that occurs, as they say in Buddhist psychology, there's nothing that appears to our consciousness that doesn't get stored there. So if you like, and then everything, every one of those, the word karma means action. So the first one, the main one, the crucial one is the mental action. That's the thought, intention. That's the beginning of the process of creating karma. All these trillions, so we're carrying around, I like, you know, using the analogy of our bank vaults of trillions of karmic seeds from everything we've said and done and thought. I mean, it sounds like a craziest idea, you know. In this life already, we think of just this person programmed with all your stuff in the brain is overwhelming. This is countless lives of stuff for the Buddha, you know. So the time of death before we stop breathing is why that time is so crucial. We can deduce logically from this process that a virtuous karma, a very powerful virtuous karmic seed, specifically a karmic seed, as Rinpoche says, practice in the context of a spiritual path. Probably even more precisely, he says, practice in the context of keeping vows of morality. A powerful morality karmic seed was triggered. They're already right there. 6, 7, 8 weeks before I zapped into my mummy's womb while she was lying there with my daddy. That seed was triggered that already has programmed me to go to my mother's womb. This is the Buddha's view. So to understand this, we have to understand the whole way karma works, which we'll talk about again, you know. We have to do that. At the same time, so I will do it now. Buddha says there are four ways that karma ripens. This, remember that every millisecond what we think and do and say sows seeds that will ripen in the future as our experiences. Unless, of course, you pull them out, good or bad. This is why I like to use the analogy of seeds and fruits, because it's a really great one. And I even like to make it even more by thinking of our life. You think of your life now, or I think of my life, using me as the example, or ourselves, is your everything in your life is your garden. So you can divide the fruits of the fruits in that garden in four broad categories. The first one is the humanity itself. The fact that your mind, in my case, my mind zapped to a human mummy's womb as opposed to a human dog's, as a dog's womb or a lion's womb or an ant egg or whatever. All of which the Buddha would say are possible. And to understand this, we've got to get, again, a bigger sense of the way karma works, which we'll try and fit in our 2 days. Already it's only half an hour, and I'm always worried I'm going to fit everything in, so I'll probably talk faster and faster. I'm sorry. What should I do? So, okay. So what in this garden, the first way, the main way that our past karma has ripened is we got a human body. And this too is an insane view to us that we created the cause. No one gave it to us. Our view clearly, if you're a materialist, you're the product of mummy and daddy's handiwork. They made you and then plonked you on this earth. That's the view, isn't it? We believe it utterly as a scientific truth. They gave us a body, no problem. They gave us a body and a brain and all the other things. This is not wrong. But the Buddhist view would be, my mind does not come from them. This takes us time if we're not used to thinking this. My consciousness, my thoughts, my consciousness itself is not a product of somebody else's. In the Buddhist view, that's a bizarre concept. Mind is the product of itself from the before. It's the most bizarre concept in Buddhism. That, you know, your mother can give you anger, give you jealousy, give you love, give you being good at music. This is a bizarre concept in Buddhism. The more you think about the Buddhist view, which one has to do, of course, because it's a very different view. So the first fruit of our past karma is, and this is all triggered at the time before we stop breathing, several weeks before we hit our mother's womb, the first way it ripens is the karmic seed that will produce a human life. This is the main one. So we really did, you know, okay, the second way, and this is simultaneous, then trillions of seeds are also triggered out of these massive bank vaults of ours, and it's a natural process. No one's judging it. It just occurs. And clearly the process is intensely intricate and highly complex. Only as we, you know, it's all in the literature, but only as we advance as practitioners do we get to understand these things, you know. It's highly complex. The intricacy of how these seeds are all triggered and ripened and so on and so forth, you know. So the second way my karma ripens at the time of death, which is producing the second category of stuff in my life, in my garden, are all the experiences. This is a fascinating one. This is a big shock to us too. First of all, producing the fact that I'll go to mummy's womb, my mummy, you know, Agnes Bliss, she was called. Well, they called her Billy because they wanted a boy, so she got known as Billy. She was Billy Bliss. Then she married Teddy Corton. My auntie, Rabina Bliss, she became Rabina Arkashauskas because she married a Lithuanian. We thought Bliss was a stupid name as kids. We thought, oh, thank God she's not called Rabina Bliss anymore, you know. My auntie, Rabina Bliss, I'm called after her. Anyway, my mummy, Billy Bliss, lying there with Teddy Corton. Oh, sorry, that's weeks later. I'm sorry. But it's all programmed already. They don't even know about me yet. They haven't even thought, they're not even a twinkle in their eye yet. I'm ahead of the game. This is why it's not, you can't blame your parents. You did all the work. You program, you come running in when the time comes. So, the second way your karma ripens is all these seeds are triggered from your bank vaults. It's called experiences similar to the cause. Experiences similar to the cause. So, if we look into our lives, we can see, can't we? We have, from the second we're conceived, we are connected to humans. We have this intense, other sentient beings. We're intensely social beings, are we not? Starting with a mother, perhaps the father, perhaps siblings, aunties, uncles, grandmas, grandpas, great aunts, nieces, nephews, this massive group called family. Then we have all the other people, the next door neighbour. Then we have, no, even before we get to the next door neighbour, we have the rats and the cockroaches and the ants and the lice and the other creatures who like to eat our houses. Their karmic connection. All the beings we meet, Buddha says, because he says karma is a natural law. Karma is a natural law, he says. No one's running it. He has observed it. Every sentient being we meet, we've got a connection with them. We've got strong history with each other. This is an insane view if we think of the materialist view, or if we think of the Christian view. There's not a single sentient being, starting with your mummy, that you're going to meet whom you haven't got strong history with. And the crucial point is this. The experience is similar to the cause karma is referring to basically how they treat you. How they see you, how they treat you. And if you think of your entire life, there are three ways in which sentient beings treat you. Well, there's two. You've got one big category of sentient beings who are known as the strangers, and that's 99.99% of the universe. Well, they don't do anything to you. They're just indifferent, because they don't do anything. So we're not even discussing them in terms of karma. You could argue that. But so the other categories, what are they? It's called friends and enemies. So we all know there are some sentient beings who do nice things to us. The poodle was cute. You know, the mummy who's kind, the father who's abusive, the rats who eat your house, the cockroaches who shit in your spoon drawer, the mosquitoes who eat you, the next door neighbor who hates you, the somebody you meet who attacks you, the person who steals from you, the person who hires you, the person who fires you. In our entire life, this is it, isn't it? We have experiences that are nice at the hands of others, and we have experiences that are horrible at the hands of others. It's pretty uncomplicated. Is this not the life of all people, all beings, all dogs, all ants, all kangaroos, all humans? This is all of this for one individual person, the recipient of all this. This is called my experiences, similar to the causes that I created in the past with those sentient beings. Karma's pretty personal. You could say like that. Because if karma is not random, for Buddha, karma is a natural law, the law of cause and effect. This is a shocking idea to us, because utterly and completely not the Christian teaching, because it's God's job. It's God made us, so God has a plan. It's not our business. And second, the materialists, we're still looking for all the answers, aren't we? This is the Buddha's view. There's not a sentient being we connect with, starting with our mother, whom we haven't got some history with. And the history that we're experiencing in this life, the way is particular to a certain set of karmic seeds as to whether we harm them or help them. So that's the experience, similar to my causes. Those seeds are triggered. So, you know, the karmic seeds that are triggered in relationship with my mother, with my father, with my siblings, with my aunties and my uncles, with the rapist when I was 20-something, or I was 26, and with the something, with the abortion I had when I was 23, with that sentient being, all the sentient beings who impact upon your life. This is experience similar to the cause. Those seeds are all triggered in the past life, before I even stopped breathing. Plan, programmed already. So that, from that perspective, it can't possibly be a random event when someone gives you $5. Oh, aren't I lucky? Or it can't possibly be random when someone steals it. This mean person stole from me. Why do they do that to me? This is the Buddha's view. You created the cause way before. And this is just a seed that's ripening now. It could have been 27 lives ago. The third set of karmic seeds that are triggered are called the actions similar to the cause. Action means here the word karma, this dynamic word, action. So the action similar to the cause is referring to all of your tendencies, your personality traits, your characteristics. And not one of these came from your parents. These were triggered before you stopped breathing in the past life. From where? From your past habits. There are a bunch of habits. You get born with habits, basically. Habit to do what? Be compassionate, perhaps. To lie. Steal. Be good at music. Be good at football. Be good at killing. Be good at eating. Attracted to this, not attracted to that. All of these are tendencies. And they've got nothing. No, you can't say they've got nothing to do with our parents. But the clear point the Buddha's making is, these are there, in our own mind, from having practiced these things before. That's the main cause. And then these powerful ones that will be the producing the personality called Rabina, or Hitler, or Mother Teresa, or whoever, or your dog, they triggered them. Coming along with this set of experiences at the hands of these people I'll meet in my life. coming along with this person, this body called a human body. This entire package. And the fourth one, the fourth lot, are called environmental karma. And this, for example, what happened? Where were we? You okay? Alright, good. So environmental karma is referring to, this is how I like to put it, okay? Now it can be quite personal, but sometimes in terms of the environment it's a little bit more distant. Not always, but that's the way I like to say it. So if you think about our environment, that doesn't just mean the trees and the moon. It means the house you live in. Let's say you live in a lovely suburb. Trees and stars and the weather's lovely, but your house is really mouldy and stinky and full of ants and roaches. And you understand, you can see this. Or some people live in an ugly suburb where it's bad pollution, but their house is really sweet and harmonious and the air comes nicely in the winter and the summer and everything works beautifully. That's environmental karma. Can be personal and can be general. We can all share the same environment where the weather's terrible. All share the same environment where it's stinky from a polluted factory down the road. So it can be personal karma. For example, we live in Raleigh and we have, access to amazingly good food and it's healthy, delicious food, organic. That's environmental karma. We created the cause to be born in a place, to live in a place where we can access delicious food. Then secondly, our body. This is environmental karma too. That you maybe have, you eat a peanut and it will kill you. That's environmental karma. It can be personal, The way it could be, for example, environmental karma could be due to killing in the past. You live in a place where people are dying young and there's lots of death around you. It's not like your aunties and uncles, but you're in an environment like that. That's called environmental karma. So if you think of your life, there's the entire environment in which you live, including the moon, the stars, the trees, including the people, including the activities, like living in a place where there's terrorism, it's fearful all the time, like living in a place where there's no delicious, lovely things and it's very fearful and lots of burglars and muggers and gangs. That's environmental karma for you. It's not in your house. Or you live in a place that's sweet and peaceful and people leave their doors unlocked and nobody steals anything. Everything's lovely. This is, everything, this is environmental karma. Main cause, your actions that produced you to be born in that environment. As Lama Zopa says, and this is quite subtle, we've got to understand this really more and more deeply as we practice, and this is helping us understand emptiness, that whatever any sentient being experiences, it's your own karmic appearance. It's yours. Whereas, how do we think? I didn't ask to get born. It's not my fault. How dare there be pollution? Whose fault is it? It's not my fault. These ugly people, how dare they make my life so unhappy? And then if it's good stuff, we just eat it up for breakfast and demand more, thinking we deserve it. Because I didn't ask to get born, did I? Just pot luck. Good luck and bad luck. Or it's God's plan. And that's okay. That's a much better view. And you be humble and you thank God. Nothing wrong with that. This is not, Buddhism is neither of these. You look at it and you go, look at this, and I've got this beautiful environment, amazing. I must have been so, for example, one action called killing. All actions we do, negative or positive, can have any of these four results. So one example of, say, non-killing, a strong, in your mind, strong intentional non-killing practice in the context of keeping vows of non-killing, how that would ripen in these four ways is this. One would be a good, healthy human body. Two would be no tendency to kill. What a miracle. Look at most humans on this earth. Most humans kill something. Even most religions, with respect, teach that it's cool to kill creatures. I was taught as a Catholic that God made all these other beings without a soul for humans' benefit. That's okay. I'm not complaining. Just looking. The Buddha's you, not like that. So, okay. So then the second way our non-killing karma would ripen, you'd wake up in this life with no thought to kill and, no wish to kill. Wouldn't occur to you because you've trained yourself in non-killing. The third way that non-killing would ripen would be no one would kill you and you wouldn't die young. You'd live a nice fat old age, never threatened by anybody. That's the result of non-killing. Long life and either you don't die young and no one kills you. The fourth way non-killing karma ripens is you have a really healthy body and the food and the water and the physical world that impacts upon you makes you healthy. I think of Warren Buffett. I read his biography. This rich businessman. He gave all his $55 billion to Bill Gates Foundation. And he's renowned as a fairly down-to-earth guy. He wears the same old clothes and drives the same old Toyota and lives in the same old house for the last 60 years or something. And he's got very simple eating tastes. And his daughter says, he's 86, I think, I've never seen water pass his lips, she said. his diet, since he can remember, unfailingly, cheeseburgers, Coca-Cola, and vanilla ice cream. And he's as fit as a fiddle. Now that should destroy all scientific findings about health. It should, shouldn't it? It's like completely smashes against the logic of nutrition. But we just go, oh well, he's unusual. We just sort of put it in the too hard basket. Do you understand? From the Buddhist perspective, he is experiencing the fruit, especially of environmental, he's lived long, means no one's killed him, and he hasn't died young, that's from non-killing, the experience similar to the cause, specifically, of the past action of non-killing, in past lives, and second, the environmental karmic results of non-killing, he's experiencing those. So the very environment you live in and how everything impacts upon you, all the sentient beings who impact upon you more closely, all your own tendencies and even your own humanity, who's the main cause of this? You, baby. That's a shocking concept, isn't it? Because we're always looking around wondering who did it to me, you know? Who is it? Where is it? Who's to blame, you know? Isn't it? So this is Buddha's view. He says, sorry, honey, you're the one. You're the boss. You did it. So the implication of this is kind of intense. I better get on with the job and start planning for the next decent life I'm going to have. I can't leave it to somebody else. I better start planning it. That's the conclusion, which has taken me... I mean, I've been hearing this stuff quite a few years. And it's only during this book this kind of really kind of became clear to me. Because why? Because we're so addicted to feeling I'm this permanent, inherent entity that somehow the handiwork of somebody else. We're very addicted to this view, which is blame and punishment and reward mode, you know. No such thing in Buddhism. So it takes time to process this one. Any questions so far? I'm just trying to describe the death process, okay? This is before you stop breathing. This is what all occurs. We're going to go slowly, but any questions so far? Yeah. Microphone. Can we close the door, please? Robbie or somebody? I feel all the kind of feng shui energy flies out the door. Keep it in, you know? Go, yes. What's the question? Oh, okay. You next.
My question
yes.
is that our consciousness,
yes.
consciousness...
A bit closer, I think. With your mouth closer to the microphone.
Our consciousness, mental consciousness, carries all the actions.
Yes, karmic imprints, yes, yes.
And then it goes to the next life.
Yes.
And then, you know, you carry that.
That's right.
And then... You have to get rid of it.
The bad ones. The bad ones.
The bad ones.
The negative ones, yes.
But how the person, like, you know, our story of Ashoka.
Yes.
King Ashoka.
Yes.
He killed so many people in the war. And when he came in contact with Gautam Buddha.
Yes.
He completely transformed.
Yes.
Now, how can we...
Get rid of the bad seeds. Okay.
Yeah, how
absolutely.
Can we
absolutely.
Clarify.
Yes.
Explain.
Perfect question.
And... Buddha himself was a prince.
Yes.
And he has luxurious life.
Yes, exactly.
And he changed completely.
That's right.
And can you elaborate?
Yes, exactly. We'll go into this.
Okay.
I will explain. Exactly. Yes. Thank you very much. I will, not this moment, but we'll talk about it. I'll explain the whole process. It'll all unfold as we talk. Okay? Yeah. Pieces will fall together. So, next one. You. In here, please. Here. This gentleman. I forget your name. What's your name, darling?
Jeff.
Who?
Jeff.
Oh, you're Jeff. That's right. That's Jeff there. I forgot. Go, Jeff.
Thanks, Real Jeff. Quick. So,
go.
You know, you at time of death, it's how your mind is. That's what you're saying.
Right. Yep.
So, like, as you're studying the Dharma, right, which is the most virtuous thing you can do, learn,
well,
practice.
Well, that's what you're doing, yeah. Let's go. Go,
when
Jeff.
You're studying it, like, I have no clue if I ever studied this in a past life.
I understand.
If certain things, like, there's certain stuff I study, and I'm like, huh? And then there's certain stuff I study that, oh yeah, I get that.
Okay, go.
So is that an indication that maybe I built up some dharma stuff
keep,
in past
okay,
life?
Of course, keep it simple.
That's the
keep
question.
It simple. So let's just say, we decide we go out and join those kids playing some soccer. Let's say we do that.
Yeah.
And I haven't learned any soccer. Let's say you haven't done any soccer in this life. And you go out there on the field and suddenly you're really good at it. Well, the way you'd say, you know you've done nothing of that in this life, isn't it? But you can sort of deduce there's a tendency there that makes it very comfortable for you. You go, oh, this really feels very familiar to me. Well, we all have that experience, whether it's to like people, not like people, to do bad things, to do good things. Well, you know, that's a fair... No, okay, put it another way. Sorry, let's say you are good at... Let's say I see you be good at soccer. And I'd go, well, he must have played soccer before. And you said, yes, of course I did. I learned it when I was a kid. That we all understand, don't we? So because we can remember in this life that you did play soccer in this life, isn't it? But if you haven't played soccer in this life, then it's mysterious to us, isn't it? But naturally it's mysterious if you think that your mother made you. Because then there's no tendency in your mind coming from playing soccer in the past, because you came from your mummy. Are you with me here?
Yeah.
But if you take the Buddha's view as your hypothesis, and you see the product that you're good at soccer and you haven't played in this life, then clearly, logically, we must deduce there was a tendency to do that in this life from past. But you brought it with you. And that's the same with whether you lie or steal or be good at soccer. There's no difference. They're just a bunch of tendencies. And these tendencies, what I'm saying, to whether it's play soccer or music or kill, are triggered before you even leave the past body from trillions of habits in your bank vault, trillions of seeds in your bank vault. That we're carrying with us, Jeff. So this is the deduction. Of course it is. It's logical. It's a deduction. It's logical. So whether you're good at killing or whatever, it's the same. Same logic. Do you see?
So if you're getting some things, you should fire you.
What, sorry?
If you study in the Dharma and you come across something like, oh yeah, that sounds familiar, that should fire you up. This is cool because... Man, maybe I did know this.
Okay, that's fine. So don't talk. It's okay. But that's, everybody's like this.
Okay.
And whether it's, you know, I remember reading one white supremacist boy when he was 19. And he talked about, when I read Hitler, he said, wow. He said, like, it was like I'd come home. Everything he said made sense to me. I recognize all the things he was saying. We can deduce from this, it's exactly the same, whether it's good or bad. That is my point.
I see.
He had tendencies that we can call fascist. He read Hitler. Look at Mr. Trump right now. Now, he might be a nice man in other ways, but he seems to say fairly racist, fundamentalist things, among other things. Wouldn't you agree? And all the people, like, you know, yeah, kill them, the protesters, and the guy on the video now that got punched in the face, the black guy. We can deduce he is saying racist things. Would you agree with this point? Other people as well. Now, we can obviously deduce that all the people who think like that are suddenly voting for, and they're so excited to find somebody who's speaking their thoughts. And all we can say is, he didn't make them like that. They have those thoughts themselves. So where did it come from? Their own past tendencies. It's hardly rocket science. Do you see what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
That's how come we recognize anything. The little boy I often use about as the example of fishing. He was 5 years old. He saw fishing for the first time. He fell in love with fishing. He ran like a magnet. It looked the most divine thing since sliced bread. And he became a professional fisherman. That's not because his mother didn't teach him. He's got the tendency. The same story I use about my little boy, his mummy taking the lice out of his head. And he's crying, mummy, mummy, leave them alone, don't hurt them. He's like 40 now and he's never killed a living being. This is about the point about karma. So it's a principle that if you see someone good at something now, we do deduce they must have learned it in this life. We just extend that. That's all.
Perfect.
No big deal. Do you understand? You've got to hypothesize it because we can't see the proof of it yet. Do you see?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So yes, indeed, when you see you've got a habit to lie or kill, it's a wake-up call. You don't go, oh, I'm a bad person. You go, I must have practiced this, or I better stop. And then if you see the good stuff, you go, wow, isn't this great? I must keep doing it. That's the deduction, darling. That's the point. That's the way you apply this law of karma in your daily life, if you choose to live according to it. Do you see? That's the way to think. But not just your holy bits, everything. Yeah.
So back to helping someone die. If you have a parent who's done some horrendous things and...
To you.
Or...
To me.
Or
they're negative
others.
Themselves in their lives. Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And so to go there and help them die, how is it that if they've done these horrendous things and you're there to help them plant that virtuous karmic seed when they leave, how does the action of me being there...
I understand.
And I almost feel like I would be hypocritical to go there and say, oh, you've been wonderful, you've been great.
I understand.
How does that work?
I will talk about it, darling. We're going to get to the death process, and I will definitely cover that, and if I don't exact, and I will cover it, but you'd be specific at that point when we talk about the actual time, the time of death, and why the role of a person is crucial, and even answering these points here, too. Exactly the same points. In other words, we can all see in general terms, okay, this is one part of the answer. Wouldn't you agree in all of us, we mightn't be a Hitler, we mightn't be, you know, a pedophile. We mightn't be really good at bad things. We mightn't be as, you know, the best we can do is be a bit lazy and eat too much food and maybe fancy other person's girlfriend. I mean, we're not that monstrous. That's how come we're sitting in this room, because we like the idea of making ourselves better people. Wow, amazing. Don't be delighted by that. But this question here, and like you get the examples of the Milarepa, this famous Tibetan saint, who was a pretty heavy-duty dude and quite powerful dude who killed many people using kind of his intense mind, his black magic. So heavy duty, and you hear these lovely stories. I mean, my friend's in prison. I've got many friends in prison, you know, who've been gangsters all their lives, but become extraordinary people. So we can see, you know, we've all got, what I'm getting at is we've all got both negative and positive tendencies. Sometimes there's more negative and more positive and more dramatic in some people. But it's all a question of which are going to ripen at which point. So how come my friends in prison, hearing the Buddha's teachings, turn themselves around, completely, and this is where the process of purifying, we'll go into it, regretted their negative actions and have now followed their good tendencies. So yes, indeed, your mummy and daddy might have done heavy-duty things, you know, but they've also got good tendencies in there, and so to help nourish those. You're not a hypocrite. It doesn't mean they didn't do the bad things, but you know yourself you've done bad things, and if somebody just remembers you only in terms of the bad you've done, you know how painful it is, and that's what happens often with our children. They only remember the bad thing mummy did, and they think we're a monster. I mean, I can't imagine the pain of being a parent when the kid completely turns against you, because all they remember is the bad. Do you understand? But you know yourself, you've got lots of good as well. Even Hitler must have had good qualities. But we don't like to think this because we want to make a saint or a sinner. You know, we make it extreme, you know. But we all know it's far more nuanced than that. And so the other point before we go more detail, which we'll do as we go along, the essential point Buddha's making is, if we've got countless past lives, we have done countless good and bad. We've been animals in countless lives. We've done trillions of negative things. We've been Hitler-type people. We've been holy beings, but we haven't gone far enough where we haven't cut the root of all the rubbish yet. So everyone has got a massive history. You know, massive, not just this life, but masses of history. And so everybody, and this is where we have to, in Buddhist, when you study much more deeply the actual mind itself and the nature of mind, they go to it in great depth in all the literature, about how fundamentally, and this is Buddha's central point, fundamentally, the stuff that we call negative and all those imprints, and this is a really deep point, we've got to study it in depth to get it logically, that stuff is not at the core of our being, it doesn't define us. Yes, people do monstrous things, there's no doubt about it, but it's not set in stone. There's nothing inherently evil in any mind that can't, there's nothing inherently evil meaning it can't not be removed. No matter the worst racist, the worst pedophile, the worst killer, murderer, multi, whatever. That is actions, and then results will come, but fundamentally negativity is not at the core of our being, and that's Buddha's entire finding, which gives what so much hope for us. Some of my prisoners who have killed, you know, completely depressed, want to kill themselves because they think, now I'm an evil person, I'll go to hell forever, why bother? And then they hear these ones and they're so happy to want to purify, which is a practice we'll talk about, because they know they want to identify with their goodness. And the very fact that they can even hear that shows there's a potential there. But if the person were innately bad, they could, even when they hear good, they couldn't recognize it. So this is the bigger picture, which gives us much more kindness and forgiveness and compassion. And you would want, at the time of death, to nourish that part of your mummy. She might be a hideous person with negative states, but when you also realize that is what is causing her suffering, this is what brings her unbearable suffering in the future, and that's the basis of your compassion for her, that she's harming herself. Do you see what I'm saying? And then you want to encourage the good, especially at the time of death, because still she's got millions of good seeds in there, so is Hitler, but they're buried right now. But if you can nourish one, encourage one to come up, and that could be like a miracle for her to ripen before she dies, wow, how fortunate your darling mother is, you know? Do you understand? Where are you? Oh, yes, please.
My question is, I'm trying to simulate the time of death. A person is dying, or I am dying, and at that time, you are losing different, your body is becoming
old. Yes, that's right. Yes, exactly. Yep.
And there's a physical one.
Yes, exactly.
And mentally, you have a fear comes up.
Exactly.
You are losing your children.
Exactly.
Your watch, your everything.
Absolutely, that's right.
So you're panic at that time.
Absolutely, you're exactly right.
And at that time,
yes,
I want to decrease increase the panic because
exactly.
my thoughts will come, I'll carry that one.
Exactly.
So what I can
this is the whole point of this entire teaching. We're getting to it. We're getting to exactly this point. All of this is leading up to it.
So what
it'll
I
come.
Should do...
I'm telling you, it'll come.
What I should do internally and my external...
Did you hear what I said? I hear your question.
What I should do...
Do you hear my answer? Did you hear my answer? What did I say?
What you told?
What did I say to you? What was my answer to your question?
You are giving the answer out.
It's all coming. This is the point of the weekend. Everything that's here is leading to exactly that point.
But what I should do...
Jesus, God, did you hear me? Excuse me. Shh. Did you hear what I said now?
Yes.
What did I say?
No panic, basically.
I didn't say that at all. Please listen. Please listen. Listen carefully. Your question is perfect. The answers to your question is the entire point of this weekend. So every word I'm saying up will bring us all to that point precisely.
Okay.
So can you be patient and wait? It'll all come. All of this is leading to it. It's all the whole story. You understand now? Do you hear me?
Yeah.
You sure? Good. Okay. Thank you. Perfect. You get a perfect description of an ordinary death. Okay. Go. Yes. This is going to be an intense weekend, I can tell. Yes, darling.
I have a question. I am already, I don't know at what age Milarepa tried to be good. I am already quite old.
Yes, that's right.
If I start from tomorrow
yes.
to be really, really nice and follow, can I get rid of all my bad things?
You can't, no, okay, all right.
I want to be
I understand.
A better person.
That's how amazing. We should all be crying when we hear those words. It's so special. Sweetheart, If you're, you know, like, it's sort of like saying, if I start today, can I become a millionaire? You understand? No, just hear the analogy. It is possible if you're really good at making money, isn't it? So you could possibly be like Milarepa and even get enlightened in this life, but it implies that you've got to have a lot done, lots of past work in the past life. You've got to be really, really, really talented at it. And that might well be. You don't know what your talent is. You might have done so much spiritual work in a past life that you just look at goodness and you'll become this saint. It's possible, but it might not be possible. But there's never too late to start. And that's my point even here. Even at the time of death when your mummy's dying and she's been naughty all her life, it still doesn't mean you can't... This is a crucial role, and to the gentleman's question, of the person who's going to help. Such an important role that still there's something you can do to help nourish a virtuous seed at that point, that you can kind of bypass all that negativity. You'll bring it with you, but it might ripen, and then you can purify it in the next life. So it's all possible. It's all possible. Yes, it's possible.
It's better to try.
Darling, there's no question but try. You must. And it's not even a question of try. It's a question of, you know, it's like saying, if I start now growing a garden, can I get a lovely garden? You know you can. But if you only put the seeds in once a week, you won't get much of a garden. But if you do it every day and do a bit of weeding every day, darling, it can only bring results.
Thank you.
Do you hear? So there's total hope. Don't you worry. Don't you worry about it. Aren't we supposed to have a tea break as well? Don't you have a tea break as well as lunch break? You don't do that. You don't have a tea break?
American.
You mean everybody else I go in the world has tea breaks? Do you want a tea break?
Yeah.
Look, it's going to be intense. I'm going to shout like this the whole 2 days. You've got to have a break. Come on. Have it. And even if lunch is maybe, we'll be flexible with the time. Don't worry about it. How's lunch happening?
It's brown bag.
People have brought all their own lunch?
Yeah.
I hope so, because you've got to have discussions. I want you to have discussions. So please be generous with your brown bags, okay? If in case someone forgot to bring lunch. Because I want you to have discussion during lunch, okay? So I think it's good to have a tea break. Mill about, have a cup of tea. 7:15, yeah. We might have lunch a bit later. It doesn't matter, does it? We'll be right. We'll be fine. Have a 20-minute break and come back, okay? Have a breather. Good. Thank you. Previous death. At the time of the previous death, the karmic seed would, in my case, produce the karmic seed that was created by me, a very powerful, virtuous one, for all of us the same, was triggered. That would cause, that already is programming my consciousness to go, when the time is ready, to my mummy's human womb. Second, all the karmic seeds, the trillions that would produce all my experiences at the hands of other sentient beings, basically, in all of this life, called Rabina's life. The third are all the karmic seeds that will produce my personality, my traits, my tendencies, of the trillions of seeds within our consciousnesses from beginningless lives. I know it sounds insane. All this particular set that suit the package called Rabina, that make the package called Rabina. And again, there's nobody running this, and it's not random. If it's a natural law, which again is so shocking to us, if it's a natural law, like botany, like gravity, like engineering, like mathematics, like anything, the things we all know are natural laws, once you've got the law down, it runs, it's coherent, and you'll get the same results every time. Isn't it? Unless other laws intervene. And this is all occurring, and no one's running it, and it's not punishment, it's not reward, and my mother even, father mightn't even have met yet. Well, they had in case mine, they'd all had one baby. So anyway, these four are all triggered, and then you're programmed already, and even that already, this is the interesting point, these seeds, and this is the point now about helping people at the time of death, including your bad mummy, all of these seeds are triggered. The main one being what they call the throwing karma, the one that will produce the human life in this example for all of us. In order for that to be triggered, at that point, that's when the person needs to be peaceful and virtuous. Because if the mind is not peaceful and not virtuous and is freaking out or tormented or distracted or worried or anxious or angry or fearfully attached, like you were saying, that is what triggers a negative seed. This is the tragedy for most people, because most people die unhappy deaths, they're full of fear, knowing what's going on, they're either in the old people's home going crazy, no one's taking care of them, even though they're taking care of their bodies, their poor minds are demented, are confused, no one's thought about death, no one's prepared for death, so most people's deaths are terrible. We should be weeping in compassion for people. This is when we're needed. This is the period. Before that as well, best. So you can help prepare them. And we're going to go into those things. How you help the person be peaceful and virtuous and courageous at the time of the death. So they are peaceful, so that the virtuous seeds will ripen. That will bring them to a life where they can carry on their spiritual path. This is the point. It's this most intense point of their life. This is when we are needed most for our beloveds who are dying. Including your pussycat and your dog. They too have trillions of karmic seeds in their mind. For them, even too, a karmic seed that will produce them, a human life, can be triggered then. This is the Buddha's here. This is when you're needed most. So, we'll go through the death process, what happens from that point. But this is the point I'm getting at here. This is why the essence of this entire talk, which is why your question is so perfect, is all coming down to this piece. This period, because that's when the karmic seeds. And I have to say to you myself, doing this book, editing it, you know, I'm not trying to make myself as if I'm a writer of it. I'm not. Islam is over teaching, so I have to put the stuff together. I ask many Buddhist friends, you know, when do you think the karmic seed that throws you to the next life is triggered? Everybody said something different, because it's not that explicit sometimes. So we can all make up, oh, it's when the mind, it's at the time when you're in the subtle conscious, it's at the time here, it's then, maybe then, never really clear. So it took a lot of research, a lot of reading of different teachings, and getting it clear, so that we can state this so clearly, you know. As Pabonka Rinpoche says, the karmic seed, I'll read it from the book, from Lama Zopa's book. There's a few of the excerpts of Lama Zopa's book in the notes that you've got there. How come it's so fat? It hasn't got double page printed on both sides? Oh yeah, it is. Okay, good. Okay. Good. Okay, as Rinpoche says, as Pabonka Rinpoche says, so now let's go through, okay, now I think what we will do to answer people's questions in general, the purification practice for you two here, I will go through that in particular, which is about karma. But we'll discuss now this whole point of the death process itself, about the time we're describing here. And then we'll go later, we'll discuss the practices to help them the weeks and months before, you know, assuming that the person's dying gradually. Because this is the book is addressed to people who die gradually. You're also going to die, help your person who dies suddenly, and that's touched upon. But the ideal scenario for a Buddhist to die is to know you're dying and to be getting ready for it. You know, that's the best way to die. So let's go through this process. And it's described, again, in the literature in much more depth. Here it's pretty clear, but it's described in much greater detail. And the greatest yogis, the greatest meditators, can be in charge of this process. That's what's really amazing. So we'll discuss a bit about that as well. There's just, in your notes, may I just borrow one quickly, the notes? I've got the notes there now. You haven't got the notes? Thank you. Just quickly look. Oh, the bottom of the word ran out. That was very naughty of me, isn't it? Look at that. So sorry. Okay, so just briefly. Oh, what's it doing like that? Oh, everything's wrong. Oh my God. What's happened? I shouldn't look at it. I'm so critical. I can't stand it, you know. The page number's on the wrong side. Never mind, I'm happy. It doesn't matter. Half the page numbers are off. I'm so sorry, I failed miserably. I'm giving you nice notes. And poor Donna. Okay, never mind. Shut up, Romina. I'm such a critical person. I can't believe myself. Okay. Yeah, what happens at death and the 12 links and help, it sort of is just general. I haven't gone into great detail in these notes, but it gives you the overview. And then when, of course, you get Lama Zopramaje's book, you can then, I don't need it. Oh, okay. So then you can then go into more detail yourself. We'll go through it. Now, I don't know what page, I've got a different version, you see, so I don't know what page. You're going to have to look for the section called look for it, I think, somewhere there. Maybe in the front. It'll have it and you press on it. No, you can't. It's a book, isn't it? In the front and the contents, it's going to be called The Stages of Death, Intermediate State and Rebirth. There's two. The 12 links of dependent arising and the stages of death, intermediate state and rebirth. Can you see them? For the people in the book, you've got Lama Zopa's book, page 47. Okay. I've got a different version. I've got the free PDF. I'm not trying to take wisdom sales away, but you can get a free PDF of it. A different version. Excuse me. That was naughty. Okay. Okay. So we'll go through the stages of death, that one, and I'll refer to the 12 links. Okay. So I'll just sort of talk from Rinpoche's book. So even though we all go through the eight stages, this is from the Vajrayana teachings, okay, the most advanced teachings in Buddhism, the most, you know, and this is also the model of the universe and of beings that the Tibetan medical system uses, okay. So even though we all go through these eight stages at the time of death, what I describe here is a gradual death. So those who die violently or suddenly go through the same stages very quickly. And sometimes in a violent death, the mind can leave the body immediately and go straight to the state after death that they call the ibado or the intermediate state, which is, you know, like that. In other words,
Page 50.
Okay. Oh, that's page 50. Yes. Oh, okay, fine. So the thing is here, it's a bit like, you know, if you walk down 50 flights of stairs, you go through the 50 flights, don't you? But you can fall down the 50 flights, don't you? You still go through the 50 flights, but real quick. No chance to get a hold of yourself. Same with death, okay? You understand? Okay, as I mentioned, the great meditators, those who have deeply familiarized themselves with these stages in meditation during their lives, can recognize the stages of death as they occur and can meditate on emptiness throughout. They can, in other words, they can stay, this is a point that again is so abstract for us because we don't talk like this in our modern models of the mind. According to this model, we've got gross consciousness. I began to mention this last night. We've got gross consciousness, which is all our sensory and all of our gross kind of level of putting two and two, how we can put two and two together and whole blocks of information, you know? So then that's related to your gross body, and these are inextricably linked. In other words, it's obvious, isn't it? You've got an eyeball, which is the physical, but your eye consciousness, from the Buddhist point of view, consciousness is not physical. It's that part of your mind or your consciousness that functions through the medium of the eyeball to have a moment of visual awareness. So clearly, you can have an eyeball, but without the consciousness, which means your lid would be open, the eyeball's not working, you can't see anything. It's not the eyeball that sees, it's the consciousness that enables the eyeball to function. That's the way of saying it, okay? And our body the same, the tactile consciousness, the eye consciousness, ear consciousness, tongue consciousness, and, you know, this one, isn't it? That's a consciousness? No, smell, yeah, right, okay. So the first stages of this, 8 stages of death, it's a gradual, basically what it is a gradual deconstruction of all the bits and pieces that make up a human being. As the Buddha would call it, he divides it into 5 categories. There's a whole teaching in the sutras called all about the 5 aggregates. A collection of bits, you know? And he's got particular reasoning and logic to why he chooses those 5 bits. Initially it seems a bit arbitrary why he'd pluck out these 5 pieces. But essentially we're made up of bits and pieces, okay? And these bits and pieces are deconstructing, ceasing functioning. Each of these pieces at different stages dissolves, ceases to function. By the time you get to the 4th stage, that's when the West calls you dead. You're ready for the body bag. But you're not dead yet. The breathing has stopped. You're called brain dead, but you're not dead yet because the gross consciousness has ceased. So then but what's happening now is the subtle consciousness is now there. But to the eyes and in the normal view in the world, it's not visible. You can't see the evidence of that. Although there are ways of checking very easily, and we'll describe this as we go along. So we continue to do this deconstructing process. Now the subtle consciousness, which actually includes like a grosser level of our subtle consciousness, is actually all these thousands of different conceptual states of mind. They're called subtle, you know, and they're gradually ceasing. And it's a really kind of subtle process. There are 2 main books that are published that you might find useful. One that was published 30-something years ago by Lachi Rinpoche, and it's called Death, Intermediate State, and Rebirth. And it goes into quite a lot of technical detail about all these things. It's quite interesting. It's edited by Jeffrey Hopkins. That's been out for 30, 35 years. Another one more recent by His Holiness, it's now known as The Mind of Clear Light, and that also is this very lovely teaching on this same type. It's, you know, mentioning many other things that Lama Zopa doesn't mention, but it's not, and it's touching it touches in passing on how to help. But Rinpoche is specific with all this manual, you know. But the same thing about the death process, and it's commenting on a text by the Panchen Chökyi Gyaltsen, I think, one of the earlier Panchen Lamas. That's a very wonderful book as well, also edited by Jeffrey Hopkins. Very helpful. There are 2 I can think of. There must be more. There must be more, but these are 2 good ones. Okay. And so then so subtle consciousness is also inextricably linked with its set of physical components. Inextricably. And this is where it's a different model altogether. It's the same as the Tibetan medical system, and this is similar to the Chinese one. So the components of the subtle body, or the subtle physical energy, they call it, there's this subtle nervous system that we have, they say, that goes throughout our body. 72,000 subtle channels in this subtle nervous system. But this is similar to the Hindu one, the Chinese, different model, but similar. And through these subtle channels are coursing these subtle wind energies. You see, one of the crucial things about the universe, including the physical beings, is that we're all physical matter, according to this model, are made of the 4 elements. Now, this is how we used to talk back in the medieval times, at the time of, Galileo and that mob, even our medical system, we talked about the 4 elements. Now, of course, in our modern science, we have a million different elements and all sorts of things. But this is still the same model they use in Buddhism. And essentially, the fundamental building blocks of universes are the matter, the 4 elements, and consciousnesses. And there's this fascinating description, especially in Tantra, the Vajrayana, about the intimate relationship, and Lama Zopa says in particular in the Kala Chakra Tantra, there are these detailed descriptions of the intimate, inextricable and intimate relationship between physical matter, which is the outside world made up of the 4 elements, and the internal, which is consciousness. And what's so interesting about this whole model, and that's so relevant here, is that all consciousnesses, and the Buddha would say there are countless, countless trillions. There's not an atom of space you won't find consciousnesses. It's a very different view we have. All having the same status of being beginningless, endless, not physical, and being programmed by the every millisecond of the mental and physical and verbal actions of those sentient beings that produce the experiences of those sentient beings. The ants, the dogs, the giraffes, the birds, the worms, the bugs, the microcosmic tiny creatures living in our body, the humans. There are others called God realm, which is equivalent to heaven. There are others called hell realm beings. There are others called spirit beings, very suffering, hungry ghosts. There's a whole spectrum from the Buddhist perspective, Buddhist observation, of all these sentient beings, all, you know, in one set of these sentient beings, we're all called, we're in the desire realm, they call it, which is like the realm, the six different, like, suburbs in this realm of existence, and it's known as a desire realm, or a realm of attachment. All these sentient beings, all the way in the spectrum of incredible bliss, which is called the God realms, to the most intense level of suffering in the worst suburbs, if you like, which are called the hell realms. So Buddha agrees with the Muslims and the Christians. There are these states of being, you know, known as hell experiences. But the difference is, the Buddha would say, all these sentient beings are experiencing the fruits of their own past actions, which is why it is so tragic, and which is why it's the basis of such compassion. Such compassion. All sentient beings, so suffering, you know. So all these sentient beings, all experiencing the fruits of their own actions every millisecond, and every millisecond programming their own consciousness based upon their thoughts and their minds and their actions with their future experiences. This is the Buddha's view. So this intimate relationship between the internal and external, the body and mind, we're in it, there's all these consciousnesses are inextricably linked with their own set of the four elements, inextricably. So the gross level could be a dog, you know, spirit beings, very suffering, like hungry ghosts, if you could say, their minds are conjoined with air energy, mostly, predominantly. Animals and us, with these big fat, you know, walking sewers here. Gods, these highly evolved, not highly evolved, but very blissful beings, due to virtue. These are real states of being, according to Buddha. Not made up, you know. They're all psychological states. Because the mind is the thing that we're talking about here. And everything, any sentient being is a psychological state. It's a pretty good word. Buddha didn't use the word psychology, did he? He didn't speak Greek, did he? But he says the word mind. It means the same thing. So the gods are these beings experiencing the fruits of virtue. And their minds are blissful. And you could say their minds, their energies, their physical energies, their four elements are manifested as light energy. Still in samsara though. They haven't finished the job. So all minds are inextricably linked with their own set of the four elements. This is the way the universe is, you know. And all physical matter out there as well, the universes, they're also beginningless. Can't be created. They're not created by somebody else, and they don't come from nowhere. Therefore they have to be beginningless. Which is something we just spend the weekend talking about, you know, to get our heads around it. Because they're all the product of cause and effect. One time with Holiness, in all his discussions with the scientists these last 30 years, these amazing books have been published. This marvellous discussion between all the best brains in the West and the Dalai Lama and some of his mob, you know. As he said, you know, Big Bang, yeah, no problem. Just stop the first Big Bang, that's all. So even this universe began at some point, of course it did, the four elements. And the way they describe in detail, which is probably similar to our teachings back in the Middle Ages, you can describe in detail these four elements and how all four elements have components of each other. You know? It's a really intricate explanation of the physical universe, even though we don't use that model in our world anymore, but the Buddhists do still. So we've got gross consciousness linked to the gross body. That deconstructs gradually, gets to the point where it's stopping breathing. The evidence of a person in the Western world has now ceased. But the subtle consciousness is now there, and that continues to deconstruct. So the physical components, we've got the subtle nervous system, we've got the wind energy, the subtle wind energy, the prana, the wind energy, the air energy that courses through those channels, and this is what's interesting, so different from our model, all of our different states of mind are connected to those winds. They say the mind rides on the winds. So when you go to your Tibetan doctor, she'll feel your pulses. And she feels this imbalance of certain wind energies, and she knows, because she knows, that that's connected to your attachment mind, your attachment energy, and your mind's berserk, the over-conceptuality of never stopping thinking that produces anxiety and worries and up and down like yo-yo, that's attachment energy, you know, the mind berserk. She feels that. So she gives you a certain medicine, a herbal medicine, that calms your wind energies down, which indeed, because your attachment energy is connected to it, that gives a chance for your mind to calm down. This is how they talk, you know. So this gradual deconstruction of this energy, the third component of this subtle body, as they call it, the subtle physical, is this red and white kundalini, or this red and white subtle drops, they call it in Tibetan, that are the subtler form of the gross egg and sperm from the mother and father, according to this model. So this subtle red and white drops, they say, which are the subtle aspect of the egg and the sperm, they come at the time of conception, they come together, the egg and sperm, as we call it, come together, this subtle red and white drop, as they call it, the Buddhists, come together, and then our subtle consciousness, and we're going to go through the death process, I'm leaping now to conception, will come together and will join that subtle red and white drop. That's the beginning of the person, and that starts at the heart chakra, right here, right here, right here. So the death process is this gradual deconstruction of all the warmth, the consciousness gradually ceasing, the air energy ceasing, the subtler levels of mind ceasing, the air's absorbing, everything finally all comes to the very subtle consciousness and the very subtle physical energy, which is this subtle red and white drop at the heart. And that's where we begin and end here. The person. Right? So this is why at the time of death, which we'll talk about more in a minute, the evidence that the mind is still there is very clear. You put your hand above here and you're going to feel vividly some warmth. That's the proof in Buddhist view the mind is still there. It's sitting there. It hasn't left the body yet. And the person is not dead until that very subtle consciousness has left the body. This is why they like to leave the body for 3 days. Best. Which we'll talk about. So this process is described, like I said, in immense detail, but in this book, brief detail, but still good enough to get a sense of it, you know? This gradual deconstruction of these components, ceasing, stopping. So we'll go through that process now, okay? Are we communicating here?
Yeah.
Okay, good. All right. So anyway, Rinpoche says, great meditators, those who deeply familiarize themselves with these stages of meditation, can do it through the death because they spend their entire life meditating. There's a lovely little section here called, death is what the yogis have been waiting for. That's shocking in our culture. That sounds like they're depressed, you know? Not at all. The simple reason, the logical reason, is because this, when you get to the very subtle consciousness, inextricably linked with the very subtle drop, this is the point of all this stuff, and the greatest meditators and the yogis, the point of all of it, is to get our mind to this very subtle level, which is the most potent, most capable, most clear, most amazing of our mind, that's utterly unencumbered by all the dramas and all the junk. That is the one that's most capable of cognizing emptiness, getting realizations, even becoming enlightened at the time of death, and the greatest yogis can do that. They've literally spent their lives preparing for this. Not because they're depressed, because that's the time, that's the microscope of their mind that's the most capable. And they've been training all their lives through their meditation to get to the one. Because the time of death, it's the most radically capable level of consciousness that's able to then get all the realizations, get all rid of all the rubbish and even become enlightened then. So for them it's super necessary, and this is why they're looking forward to death, not the way we think about it. So they can recognize all these stages of death. They can go through death with absolute clarity. Each step of getting less conscious, less, and when the breathing stops, they're completely conscious at the subtle level. They go through the process because they've trained in their lives. And they get to the very subtle level. Then our mind might stay there for up to 3 days before it leaves the body. But they can stay there for days, weeks, months, years sometimes. There's much evidence of great meditators doing like this. Then they're meditating. And they're getting all their realizations. And some can even become enlightened at that point. Because it's the most capable level of our mind. So what's fascinating about this process, though, this whole death process, it's exactly the same process of going to sleep. Identical, physiologically and psychologically. It's the same process. It's just death is more radical. When you die, and then you have the next level, you're accessing your subtle consciousness, that's exactly what happens to us when we sleep, and that's like the dream state. What dreams is our subtle consciousness. It's the consciousness where the grosser level of our sensory and our gross conceptual, which depend upon our brain, they have temporarily ceased. So now our subtle consciousness is experiencing dreams. Of course, most of us don't know what's going on. We can't control it. They're weird, wacko experiences. They can be very fearful sometimes. They can be very blissful and radiant, can't they? But this is your subtle consciousness. And the greatest meditators in their daily life can learn through their concentration techniques, these amazing techniques that came from the Hindus, these concentration techniques, they can cease the grosser level, not dying, but they can get to their subtle level, access it, then they can train themselves to use their subtle consciousness to get realizations because it's more potent, it's more powerful. And then in the tantric methods and the Vajrayana methods, because they are so powerful, and these are highly technical, as Ramayeshi says, tantra is highly technical, they can, through these techniques, they can get their mind to the very subtle level. They're training, you know, to become enlightened. It's a very technical point. There's nothing holy about it. It's very technical. So when we dream, and then what happens, and when you die, you go to the, you don't, not, even not yet the intermediate, but your mind, the subtle consciousness is still there. It's like a dream mind. And then you get to the very subtle consciousness. When you've got very deep sleep, there's no awareness, no dreams even, that's your very subtle consciousness, and you're asleep. There's no awareness at all. So when you wake up, isn't it, you wake up in the same body. But when you die, you go through the same process, but you wake up in another body. Big surprise. No wonder we can't remember anything, you know. Big shock. Wake up with claws and wonder what happened, you know. You understand? It's quite a traumatic experience, dying. Obviously. And the reason it's all traumatic is because of fear and attachment. Not because in its nature traumatic. For these yogis, it's a blissful experience because they haven't got fear, they haven't got attachment. They're able to go through this amazing process. But for us, it's mostly tormented because we've got so much attachment. Therefore, so much fear. Which is why you're needed at that time to help the other person. So these things occur, these visions, these certain things they talk about in the death process we'll describe, they occur at each of these stages. And the yogis are super familiar with these. You know? But for us, we go through this process every time we go to sleep. But who remembers anything? You go to bed, you wake up 8 hours later, isn't it? No memory of anything, because we don't recognize the process. So one of the great meditations that Rinpoche gives us to do is practicing going through these 8 stages. At least become familiar with it in your meditation and even when you go to sleep. So when you do come to the time of death, you have, with less fear, you can be even conscious. Whereas the greatest yogis are totally familiar with it. They know, they go through it exactly and know what's going on. That's amazing, you know. So even though we might know these stages intellectually, these 8 stages we'll go through, not having trained our minds in the meditation techniques during our lifetime and not having created enough virtuous karma or purified our minds, we can't recognize these experiences as they occur. But it's possible. Rinpoche discusses this later in another section. Okay. All right. So very, just broadly speaking, okay, the first 4 are the gross consciousness gradually ceasing and the gross physical energy. And there's various things that occur at each of these 4 stages. Various components of us, using the Buddhist model, deconstruct, cease functioning. So okay, the first one, in general it's the body, just keep it simple, the body, our gross body, the earth element, and there's also this, you know, the body becomes thinner and the limbs become loose and unmanageable. And you feel also like you're sinking. So your body becomes like very heavy. And when you're dying, you feel like you're sinking. And as Rinpoche says, when the earth element ceases, you know, you almost, like even you might reach up to hold on to something. I remember when I was very sick in India one time. I had hepatitis and malaria. No one noticed the malaria because I was bright yellow. They just thought I had hepatitis. It was in Delhi. It was like 100 degrees every day with no AC. I was hallucinating. I don't know. In Australia we say, you don't know whether you're Arthur or Martha. It's a great saying. I didn't know whether I was Arthur or Martha. Completely lost, hallucinating. And nobody recognized I had malaria. Because the fevers you have with malaria are really intense. Like you're hallucinating. You get these boiling hot, freezing cold. And they go on and on and on until you stop them. So people kept thinking I had only had hepatitis because I was bright yellow. But those fevers last only a few days. But I was having fevers for weeks. I think I lost like 30 pounds in 10 days. I just couldn't eat a thing. The boiling hot weather. I thought I was completely going crazy. And then someone saw me having a fever one day. And they said, my God, you've got malaria, you know. So they stuck me in a hospital where there was AC. I'll never forget as long as I live. I was looking bliss. I couldn't believe it. I'll never forget that as long as I live. It was like a gift from heaven, you know. This cool air on my poor tormented body. But the point is this. I remember at some point, at a certain point then, I remember feeling that my body sinking into the bed. I felt that. I'm very vivid. So it was almost like I was going through the death process, but clearly I didn't die yet. Here I am again, you know. But it was a very vivid feeling. The body sinking. The body sinking, you know. Feeling it in the bed. I remember that. So then at the same time, There's a capacity of the mind. They call them the five wisdoms, but don't get all holy about it. All it is a capacity of the mind, the way it we process in our daily life. So this first one, they call it the mirror-like wisdom, and it's the capacity of the mind, when you're wide awake and wound up, to hold a lot of information. And Rinpoche says it's related to the eye consciousness. You can see it, like right now you're looking. There's masses of things around in this room, and we can take them all in, can't we? But look what happens when you start to fall asleep. You're talking to, look, I'm talking to Tendron, and she's talking to me, and I can hardly hold any information, can you? You're struggling to stay awake, because what's happening is the process of sleep is beginning. So there's very powerful, compelling feeling of the body getting heavy. Your eye consciousness, your eyes are open, but you're feeling all this. You can see all this stuff, but suddenly your ability to hold it all is shrinking, isn't it? And then the next one is your eye consciousness ceases. So even though I'm looking at her, I can hardly see her, can I? Because all these energies are ceasing to function. They're deconstructing. Do you understand? We have that experience, isn't it? And then there's a subtle, they talk about the subtle indicator, or like a subtle sign that occurs, they call them a vision, you know, that occurs at each stage. We never recognize this. We go to sleep, we never notice these, but the yogis can. And these are really good signs. These are good things to become familiar with. And this, they say, at this point, it's related to the earth element. So the earth element has ceased. So now the water element is more prevalent, isn't it? And so you think the sign here is they call it a mirage. What's a mirage? It's like interplay of water, earth and water, isn't it? That's a subtle inner thing. Only the yogis can see this, or if you're really trained. So then now what's happening is the water element is prevalent. So this is all a very kind of... this. And also one of the hardest things here was they never spell out when they describe this in the text how long it lasts or when it begins. But I remember Rinpoche says a few things here, and you can deduce from this that in general it could be, it's a few hours or even a couple of hours. So when this process, this is a death process. This is like, you know, you're wide awake and you're doing your work, and suddenly at some point the sleep process is beginning. You start to feel tired, isn't it? Your body's heavy. That, you know, it's not long before you go to sleep, is it? Unless your mind's so berserk you can't go to sleep. It can be very quick. That's the eight stages. So just death, this doesn't, some people say that it lasts for days, but it seems to be from what they're saying, it's a few hours. So the next one, the capacity of your mind to distinguish between pleasure, pain and indifference, you know? If you're wide awake and you're really hungry and you smell that food, you can't resist, isn't it? But if you're tired, who cares? Isn't it? You'd rather sink into oblivion than go, the food doesn't matter so much. The feelings are less distinct for you. There's not such a vivid distinction between them, isn't it? Because everything's sinking, you know? This feeling is. Then there's this, they call it the wisdom of equanimity, which is, I don't get this one. Never mind, something there. I don't understand that one. Sees these three together as having the same nature. I never understand that. I should have asked Rinpoche, but I didn't. The next one is your water element. The liquids dry up in your body. Okay? Now, your ear sense, your capacity to hear. There I am, talking to Tendron. And I lost the last 15 seconds, and she asked me a question. I'm embarrassed. I'm sitting up there with my eyes open, but my ear consciousness ceased. This is very common, isn't it? You're sitting there in the teachings, you're nodding off. You're still sitting up, but your ear consciousness ceased. And then Lama Zobra asks you a question. You're completely mortified. We all have that experience, right? Your ear consciousness is absorbing. Your eyes are still open, but you can't see very well. You know, and then, of course, when you're driving, this is so compelling, isn't it? You can't resist that powerful compulsion to go in, all the energy absorbing in. So, you know, you don't risk it when you're driving. Get out of the car, please, you know? And then the subtle sign here, they say it's like smoke. It seems to me it's the interplay of water, and then the next one, which is fire. And they say it's like a room filled with incense or smoke from burning green wood. Interesting. So now, it says here, there's a whole piece here, now your dying thoughts activate the karmic seed that determines your next rebirth. And this is where this took all the research to get Rinpoche's teachings clear and where to put it, because it seems it's about when you, so this is the point I'll read to you now. Here we are, the eyes have ceased, the ears have ceased. You're still there, you're still conscious, but you're losing the plot quickly, right? So as the Vanga Rinpoche says, in liberation of the palm of your hand, your dying thoughts activate the karma that will be the cause of your next rebirth, which I said before. And the activators of this throwing karma, they call it, are the eighth and ninth links craving and grasping, as discussed in the 12 links of dependent arising, which comes just before this section, which we'll talk about as well. So the trouble is here, there's this process called the 12 links, which is from the sutra teachings. Then there's this process which relates particularly to death in this case, which Rinpoche is going to discuss. Then you've got the 8 stages of death, which is from Tantra, and they don't put them together, but they occur at the same time. I remember asking one geshe, well, when does the 8th link occur in relation to the 8 stages? You know, you can't talk like that, they're different. But it's rubbish, of course you can. Well, I've done it. I've got Rinpoche talking about it. I hope it's not wrong. Took risks. Because, as the Bhagavad says, craving and grasping, these 8th and 9th links, as I said to you yesterday, I think, they occur very powerfully at the time of death. And basically, they're just attachment. And so we've got to talk about attachment to really understand this, and we'll do that after lunch. Go into what attachment is and why it causes so much suffering. But you articulate it very clearly, the gentleman in the back there. Because there's attachment, as you said, to your body more than anything, to your sense of who you are, to your beloveds, to your possessions, to your dog, your cat, your grandma, whoever it is, the stuff that we spend our lives thinking are the purpose of life. Even if we're nice people, what the purpose of our life is all the contents of our life. It's our beloveds and our family and our health and our body and our this and our possessions and our plans and all our things. This is what we see and hear and taste and touch and smell. Of course it's what's most important for us. Of course it is. Everything we do is based upon supporting and maintaining and getting these things. So naturally it's worthy. So if we've never thought about death, that's why death is, at this point in particular, is so traumatic. Because this craving, this attachment is now ripening at this point intensely strongly, more powerful than normal attachment in daily life. That's the point about it. So terrifying. So, and of course, what are you attached to but the status quo, your things? So naturally, if you've never thought about death, but you know you're dying, you know you have to leave all of this, it is beyond bearing, the fear, the pain, the grief, the loss. It is beyond bearing. So naturally, you're going to hold on as long as you can. Naturally. So that's why what's so important, we'll go to this later, the scenario for your dying person has to be calm, quiet, beautiful, and everything in that room should only be conducive for that person to die peacefully and virtuously. So get the pets out. Get the troublemakers out. Get the emotional ones out. Get all the junk and the clutter and the rubbish, the stuff that confuses the poor dying person's mind, out. Make it impeccable and beautiful. Such that whatever they see and hear can only help their mind be peaceful and calm. This is incredibly important. Even if they're in a coma, you should treat the place like a shrine room, you know, peaceful. The people who are in that room should be knowing what they're doing. They should be people who are good for that person. The person can be attached to them. It's like your mummy, let's say, can be really attached to you. But if you know what you're doing, you can be in charge. And you won't be freaking out with all your dramas and your emotions, clinging at them and crying and moaning, you know. There's no way you have your pets there, especially in the West where we're so attached to our pets. You just cling to your pets. What good is that? Distressing. Unbelievable. But so important to help the person to be peaceful and calm. Because now is the time, especially now. This is when this craving, this attachment is so intense. So naturally, one of the functions of attachment is to hold on to what you've got, to find it unbearable not to have it. We know this. And the other function of attachment, we can see it in our daily life every second, it has a function of always looking forward to something. That's what keeps us all perky and happy. Every second of the day, we're planning, right? Now I'm going to have this, now I'm going to have that, now I'm going to want this, now I'll get the cake, now I'll go to bed, now I'll get up, now I'll turn my body, now I'll move this, now I'll scratch my nose, now I'll make a telephone call. What do I do now? I'll watch television. I'm a bit bored now. What do I do now? I'll go to sleep. Well, now I'll get up, I'll have my breakfast. We never stop, isn't it? So we do it for good reasons, to help others, but it's mainly propelled by the motor of attachment. It's just how we are. That's a perky person, all happy in life. Now look at what a depressed person is. Nothing to look forward to. That's a deflated attachment. And that's when you want to kill yourself. There's nothing to look forward to. That's attachment energy. So primordial. It runs our lives. So death, this is a tragedy. You have, if you're a materialist and you've never thought of death, what have you got to look forward to? Absolutely nothing except a terrifying black hole of fear. No wonder death is so traumatic for those people. If you are a Christian and you love God, you will die very peacefully and blissfully because you're looking forward to heaven. Very practical. That's why I say, if you're a Christian mummy and she's having a panic, but she's sort of forgotten about God, remind her of God. She'll grasp onto God like a vampire. Well done. It's going to be the best thing for her. Because as Lama Zopa says in the section, which I'll also read to you. How are we going for time? Okay. In general, this attachment, Buddha says, is the cause of all our suffering. And we could spend months on this one. We'll talk about it a bit more later. But the time of death, this is especially the Mahayana view. You're going to have it anyway. It's going to happen. It's this craving is going to happen no matter what for everybody until you're highly realized. And it's going to be extra strong. So you're going to be skillful and use it. And so the grasping, which is the next one, even more powerful than the craving, number nine, that we have to train it in our daily life to look forward to our next life, to be attached to the thought of getting another human birth, for example. Then you'll die well. Then you're skillful. It's a skillful, it's using attachment. I remember a friend of mine was doing some proofreading. She said, oh, Rinpoche can't have said that. But I even had a meeting with him and he reiterated it. So it's very interesting. Are you communicating, you people?
Yeah.
If you've never heard any of this stuff before, is it a bit overwhelming and boring or what?
Yeah.
Where's Don's mum? Well, she's gone.
No, she's here.
Where are you?
Here.
What's your name again? I forget your name, darling.
There you go.
So this is a bit overwhelming for you, must be, surely. You've never heard this stuff before, have you?
Well, I've heard it from Don.
Oh, you have? Oh, that's her boy. He forced his mother to come here. Anyway, she's still here anyway. Anyway, darling, whatever. Okay. So, as Pavongarate says, this grasping, which is the ninth of these links, this is what's now triggering. This process has started, these 12 links have started at the death. So this grasping is occurring, as Pavonga says, that this takes place while the mind is still active and you can still recall virtue or be reminded of it by other people, which is now. Do you understand? So that's when they need you most, right there. If they're Buddhists, saying their prayers to them, the peaceful and quiet, you're helping them through this process. Because this grasping, when this comes, that's the energy that triggers the number two link, which is the seed, in our case, which is a human one, a virtuous one, that triggered us, which how come we went to our mummy's human womb. This is programmed right now. And if you're going to die this way, he talks about it later, you'll be very peaceful. In fact, you will even be blissful. Because as the mind gets more subtle, you get more blissful. Naturally. At this point, it's so important to be able to control the arising of all the negative thoughts, which is your job, you know. So as Rinpoche says later, when we get to the things, I'll read what he says. Okay, he says, helping others at the time of death is a big responsibility. As we've just, the people surrounding the person who's dying, friends, family, professional carers, have a big responsibility. I will put it this way. Whatever arises in your loved one's mind, whether their thoughts are virtuous or non-virtuous, very much depends upon you and other helpers, how you behave towards them. It is a great responsibility. If you are not careful, if you do not have this education, that the way you behave affects the mind of the person and therefore their future life, you will only harm them, not help them. So carry on with the death process. Before we have lunch, we'll die. Okay. So they say if negative karma is triggered at this point, this is very common, you can have terrible experiences. And many people I know who work with the dying say they see this, you know. The person's like having terrible visions. I remember one friend, a nun in Cairns in Australia, was helping a fellow. And she said, suddenly, she'd never seen anything like it. He became like this terrified demon. His eyes turned red. He was completely freaking out, seeing these hideous, like nightmarish hallucination visions. And the Buddhist view is because he's going through the death process, his mind's getting more subtle. That's an exact indicator that a negative karmic seed has been triggered and he can see his future life coming. The person who's dying virtuously, blissfully, as their mind gets more subtle, they're seeing the, you know, it could be the pure land, it could be the God realms, it could be a human, it's a blissful experience. In general, they say, and he quotes it here, when you die peacefully and virtually, for you, it's like going towards the light. It's a very blissful experience. If you die with a negative karma triggered, it's a beyond terrifying. Beyond terrifying. And this is just the way the mind works. It's the way the mind works. It's just how it happens. No one's punishing you, no one's rewarding you. It's just this technical process, you know. I remember when Steve, I read about his sister, I told you Steve Jobs, and his sister said, she was there on the day, and that lovely saying that she said, something like he was packed, ready to go. He was prepared, you know. And he was lying on the bed, skinny as a rag, he had some cancer, and his two daughters were there. But I remember the thing she did say. She was like here, then Steve was there facing her, and in between her and Steve were his two daughters, and he was looking at them. She said he could see his face. He looked with incredible love at his daughters, saying, begging them to forgive him for having to leave them. Not like clinging at them and crying with pity, you know, but really like so compassionate. And then she said she saw him look over the daughters' shoulders into the distance, and he went, oh wow, oh wow, oh wow, and he died. Well, let's hope he saw the Pure Lands. Let's hope he was heading right there. Do you hear me?
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? You've got to admit, it is interesting. So, okay. The next day is the third. This is not, you're not even stopped breathing yet. The ability... Now, one of the functions of our mind is a particular state of mind. We've got three categories of states of mind within the Buddhist psychological model. Very clear, there's no fourth category. There are trillions of thoughts, but they all fit into these three categories, which is really helpful. You know, start to calm you down when you realize you can learn to distinguish the three lots, what we have to do. The first lot is we can call the negative, the neurotic ones, all the voices of ego, the fears, the dramas, the attachment, the anger, the jealousy, the pride, all mixed together like a big soup, which are the source of suffering and pain and cause you to harm others. Then there's the positive ones, love, compassion, you know, which are peaceful in their nature, are blissful, are connected to others, they're virtuous. Then you've got this third category, which I like to call the mechanics of the mind. There's many of these, and they're all working non-stop, so many of them. There's certain five they talk about that are never stopping, every millisecond. And to do anything reasonably, even to kill somebody, you've got to have these five working nicely. Or to do something virtuous. So whether you're virtuous or non-virtuous, you need these five. So one is called, for example, discrimination or recognition. It's one that's happening every millisecond, and it's super fast and super brilliant. And the better you have this one, the better you are. You know, if you're a sniper, you've got to have incredible clarity to distinguish that person from this person. So you've got to have really good discrimination. But if you're a meditator, you've got to have really good discrimination that can see in your mind the distinction between attachment and love. So you've got to have this super focus whether you're a good person or a bad person. So this lot are called neutral, because they're neither virtuous or non-virtuous. So this discrimination, which is the ability to distinguish everything in your daily life, this is this and this is that and here's this and blah blah, but now you're lost using the plot. In particular now, you can't distinguish between friend, enemy and stranger. They're kind of all merged into one kind of blob. So you have your beloved on one side of the bed and your worst enemy here, and you've lost the plot. You can't tell the difference. Discrimination. Well, you don't recognize your friends anymore. In other words, you can't tell, you know, like, who are you? We can see with people with like senility or Alzheimer's, that particular one is ceasing to function, isn't it? It's obvious. The other one that's there all the time is called, well, one that's there that's a crucial one for us is good memory. They call it mindfulness, and we get very confused about that meaning. It's just memory, good memory. If you haven't got good meaning, remembering what you're doing from moment to moment. If we've lost that one, you've lost the plot, haven't you? So if you're losing your recognition, don't know what's the difference between this and that, and you're losing your memory, that's what we call people who become senile or having Alzheimer's, isn't it? These are states of mind. We're not talking the brain here. We're not discussing the brain. The fire element, the third element, ceases to function. You start to get cold, you know. And now the heat also begins to is leaving the body in a particular direction. Because everything is gradually coming from the top to the bottom. All the energies and everything, like I said, ends up at the heart chakra. So they say, if the karmic seed that has been triggered is a negative one and you're going to go to the suffering realm like animals or something, the heat leaves the top part of your body first and goes towards the heart chakra. And that's not a cool sign. If you feel your feet of your dead person and your dying auntie and they're all toasty but their head's cold, that's not cool. You can't change it. You can't do much about it. It's just a sign. It's an indicator, that's all. If the heat leaves the head last, that's an indication that you're going to go to one of the, have a decent rebirth. The way the heat leaves the body. So now the fourth, the vision then is some kind of like fire sparks, which if you think about it is the interplay of fire and air, isn't it? Now the fourth step, the fourth one, this is now, you can't even move your own body and your awareness of just who you are and all your worldly activities, you've lost the plot completely. As Lama Zopa says, you know, normally you hear a word, you can put all the meaning to it. And if you think of the way we think of our life, we've got this really intricate, huge, like vast picture we have in our mind now that we have built up since we're born about who we are. I'm a this, I'm a Democrat, I'm a communist, I'm a nun, I'm a fat, I'm thin, I'm short, I'm tall, I'm a Buddhist. These millions of names and labels and ideas we have. I like jazz, I don't like this. This vivid sense of who we are, this massive picture. You've lost the plot by now. You haven't got a clue. Okay? Cease to function. The tongue consciousness ceases. Apparently the tongue shrinks and turns blue at the roots, apparently. And I always quote this, Geshe Rabchen, one of Lama Zopa Lamayeshi's gurus, I met him, he's one of my teachers too. He said, that tongue that has spent its life gossiping is now useless. Okay? Your tactile consciousness ceases. And the air goes out and doesn't come in. People all talk, he doesn't say that here, but everybody who is dying, people say, it seems to me the breath goes out longer and there's a bigger spaces between when it goes out and when it comes in, you know? And then eventually it goes out and doesn't come back in. So the air consciousness is, the air element has ceased. And the vision, they say, is like, the way they say it is, of course this is impossible for us to see, but the yogis see it. It's like a vision of a flame. It's like light around a flame, like a dim red blue light, they say. So this is when you're ready for the body bag for the West. This is when you're called brain dead, but you're not dead yet. So the classic scenario, and this Rinpoche gives these teachings, is you now, you know, you keep going through this process, but you don't touch the body for 3 days. So later, once we go through the different scenarios and what to do when your loved one has stopped breathing. There's what to do if your loved one dies at home, which is not that many people. What to do, and then that you could if you can, that's really the best, is to leave for 3 days. What to do if your loved one dies in hospital, there it's really hard. You've got a half an hour, if you're lucky. And we'll go through this later, after lunch. What to do if your loved one dies suddenly, and that's when you really need training, because everybody panics at that point. And what to do if your loved one gives their organs, we discussed this last night, but we'll do it in more detail here. And of course, what to do if your loved one's a yogi or a meditator. Well, that's a whole different scenario. So now, there's the final stages of death occur, and this can take time. This can take those 2 days, or it can happen very suddenly. And of course, it's not evident to you by looking, because the body has ceased. You can't see evidence of any life there. You could by feeling if there's still warmth, but that's the only indication, which is a really good indication apparently. So easy, even on your dog as well, it's easy. So now this is just described briefly here. Michelle talks about how the wind energies in the right and left channels, okay, roughly speaking they talk in this model, which is the same as the Tibetan medical one, but a central channel, which is just in front of the spine. If the spine came all the way up, it would be just in front of the spine. And there's this, and then you've got these two side channels, they say, that start here and go up and then go all the way down. And all these three channels end at the tip of the penis for the male and the tip of the cervix for the female. And these are towards the back of the body. Then you have all these other 72,000 channels. And they're not so, I mean, they're all kind of entangled and messy, you know. So at each point here, 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 below the navel and several down below, there's like these kind of coming together, a whole bunch, all knotted together. And these are called chakras. They're these, you know, and there's basically where they block the entry of the mind and the winds into the central channel. So the point about, okay, the whole point for the great yogis and for any of us when we meditate is to try to practice, using the tantric model, trying to practice to get all the wind energies and our grosser consciousnesses to the consciousness, past all these blocks into the central channel, because then the mind can be very powerful, very focused, and you can then meditate and get realizations. But this is what prevents these blocks in the channels. It's all very complex, you know, how they talk about it. So basically, this process now is death, it's happening, and sleep it happens. So now what happens is the airs in the left and right channels move up and open up the head chakra, as they say, loosening the knots there, and then these winds enter into the central channel. And so this causes what they call this white and red kundalini, they often refer to as white and red bodhicitta, or white and red drops, the essence of which comes from the mummy and the daddy, but which are mixed with our own energies in the body. This now, which is prevalent at the crown chakra, which is the source of all the bliss and the good feelings we have, this goes down the central channel and gets to the heart chakra. And then there's like a white vision, they say, like very bright moonlight in autumn. Again, remember, ordinary people don't recognize these. Then the red one comes and the winds in the right and left channel move down and then open the sex and navel chakras, loosening the knots there and enter the central channel. And this causes the red at the navel to come up, and this is the source of the heat in the body. Come to the central channel. And there's a red vision. Then the next one is these two come together and they encompass the indestructible drop, which is kind of mummy and daddy. And there's like a dark vision. And then finally we get to extremely subtle consciousness, or very subtle consciousness, which is the subtlest level of our being, obviously. And the wind, all the gross body has ceased, now these subtler physical energies have ceased, deconstructed, and now we get down to the very subtle wind energy, which is like the fundamental building blocks of the next person, the next physical body, and the very subtle consciousness inextricably linked together. The very subtle wind and the very subtle mind. This occurs every time we go to sleep. This occurs every time we die. And the yogis can do this. This is a training we have to go through to become conscious of this, which is advanced, of course. So now if you're ordinary people, you could stay there for up to 3 days. And the yogis can stay there, but they're conscious and they can meditate for days, weeks, months there, if they like. So this very subtle consciousness, the best way to put it is, it's like carrying all the bank vaults of all the trillions of karmic seeds. It's the only analogy you can use. Here we're talking about mind, which is not physical. You've got to use analogies, you know. It's so abstract otherwise. Because remember, every millisecond of whatever we think, do and say can only leave imprints in the body, the mind. Nothing goes astray. There is nothing that goes astray. There is no memory of anything that disappears. And this is why, from the Buddhist view, psychologically speaking, as we get more advanced, we can develop clairvoyance. We can see the past, see the future. Because we have the memories there. Some really interesting example of this. I remember watching on YouTube one time, one Christian, lovely Christian girl, who, when her mummy left when she was a little girl, and she got very depressed because she had to take care of the babies, and she got older, she always got depressed, and she got married, had babies, she got depressed, so she decided to kill herself. So she took the pills, and then she had this vision, which is like dreams, it's the same thing, dreams, but this vivid, so there's 2 points to it. Vivid experience of every major event in her life starting from the second she was born. So in other words, the Buddhist view of this is that everything that happened to us, even in our intermediate state when we pass away, we're in our dreams and between lives, everything, because the consciousness is there, everything is imprinted in it, but we don't know how to access it. We don't know how to access our memory. We don't know how to access our past lives and future lives. It's all there. The memories, but here, because she got to her subtle mind and she didn't die, she had this vivid experience, memory, crystal clear of every major event in her life, because it's all stored there. So this is what clairvoyance is. And Buddha says we can all accomplish that. Buddha says we've had this countless lives. Everyone has capable of this. But the other interesting point, by the way, I thought this was mind-blowing. Every one of those experiences, the vivid experience she had of each event, it was completely from the point of view of the other person. Isn't that incredible? Like, incredible empathy. So she woke up and must become a very blissful person, you know. That's amazing. I can't get over that. Every experience, she saw it from the point of view of the other person. And she realized how selfish she'd been all her life, you know. Because depression is not being rude, but it's all about me, isn't it? Naturally, it's how we see the world. It was extraordinary. I found that extraordinary. Anyway. So they call this the clear light. Clear light is used in many terms, many ways. In general, this is the very subtle consciousness is called the clear light consciousness. Then there's, as you know, if you've studied the, you know, Buddhist Tantra, you develop clear light realizations when you actually get your mind to become powerful. But it's a natural thing that everybody occurs. Every dog, every ant, every Hitler, everybody goes through this process. And all these imprints, all these seeds we've left in our consciousness from our past actions are like programmed there, you know. And then up to 3 days later, or immediately, or whatever, that consciousness will leave the body. So death occurs when the indestructible drop, this very subtle red and white drop coming from the mummy and daddy, which are there at the heart chakra, from the time of conception to the time we die. This splits open. And the extremely subtle mind and the wind leave the heart chakra. And depending on which rebirth you're already programmed to take, your very subtle consciousness will leave the body from different places. So if you're already programmed to be born in the lower realms, like the animals or they say the hells, the consciousness will leave through the sex organ or the anus. You can't see this, of course. You don't notice this, but that's what they say. If you're going to be born as like a hungry ghost in this very intensely suffering realm called the spirits, and we'll talk more about these later, I'll describe these more, you'll leave to the mouth. Now I find this interesting, it's my comment. You know, please leave your hubby alone, stop kissing him on the mouth as he's dying, because that can help his consciousness leave from there to straight to the spirit realm. Thanks a lot, mate. Leave him alone, you know. In general, don't touch your loved ones. Best not, because you can disturb their consciousness. If you're going to be born a human ghost, it leaves through the eyes. If you're going to be born into what they call a pure land of the Buddha, we've got to go into this. There's a whole section in Rinpoche's book about this. It'll leave through the crown chakra. Generally speaking, that's what they say. So then, the moment the indestructible drop splits open and your clear light consciousness does leave from the heart chakra, the second it leaves, even before it might leave the body itself, you now go through the reverse process. You become like what they call an intermediate state being. This is like a dream state. It's just subtle consciousness. You're at the very subtle, and it kind of wakes up as a subtle consciousness, like you're waking up in your sleep in a dream. It's slightly more gross than deep sleep, isn't it? So you can now see the world. You can now see your body. It's your subtle consciousness already now. You can see the body, you can see your beloveds, but the karma has completely finished and you have no wish to go back. Whereas, you know, many people leave their bodies and they have out-of-body experiences. You know that. Then they see their body and there's still a connection. There's still a connection and they rush back to it because the karma hasn't finished yet. So you now go through the 8 stages in reverse. This happens every time you wake up. You go through the 8 stages in reverse and you get back to being you again. You know, the gross consciousness is all happening. And that's why when you wake up in the morning and you feel your body feels like lead, doesn't it? Doesn't it? Because your earth element hasn't properly come back yet. That's why your mouth is dry, your eyes are really dry, because your liquid energy, the water element hasn't come back properly. Do you understand? That's why you can hardly put two and two together. You're so tired. All you want to do is lie, go and go back to sleep, isn't it? Because all your elements haven't come back fully yet. That's why it's best to hop out of bed immediately and you'll come back to life, I promise. That's what I do with people who are dying or overdosed on a drug. They can walk around, so keep the elements moving, you know? Do you understand? So feeling of tired is because all your elements aren't back in normal, isn't it? And if we're lazy, we'll snore, go back and snore again, isn't it? Yeah. Okay. So now, you go through these 8 stages of the reverse process, starting from the second your consciousness leaves the heart chakra. And then you literally wake up, it's like in a dream state. Intermediate state, the bardo, is exactly like a dream state, but just much more dramatic, much more powerful, much more intense. And it very much, the character of it, just like your dreams, is the same as, is determined by the karmic seed that has been triggered. So it can be like a nightmare, terrifying, like nightmarish visions. Be very intense, very fearful, very dreadful. And then what's going to happen is, then eventually, say you've been created the karma to be a dog, you're kind of going to wait for your mummy and daddy dog to get together, you know, for the egg and sperm to come together, isn't it? And then you see them and you run like a magnet. You're attracted to that mummy and daddy. You run like a magnet to that delicious lion mummy's womb, or that delicious doggy womb, because that's the karma you created. It'll look very powerful to you. It'll look very delicious to you. But you hang about in this intermediate state until they come, until you find that new rebirth, you know. They say it could last up to 7 weeks. You know, like that. And every time, after a week, like a little mini-death, and you have another intermediate state, like many dreams throughout the night. Same, you wake up and you go back to the same dream, isn't it? Like that. Intermediate state. Something like that. I'm being very rough about it. Very easy. Very. So then, but if you're programmed to be born a human, there I was in about May 1944 having died, kind of, you sort of, there's no thought of where your new mummy and daddy are, unless you're a highly realized being. Then you can plan your rebirth perfectly. You know exactly when to go. I make a stupid joke and I say, you've booked your womb in advance. I can't resist saying this. I'm so stupid, I know. But for the yogis, literally true. They know exactly where they want to be reborn, you know. And for us, you just have a freak out panicking. And there's this tense sense of grasping, kind of waiting for another basis of another me. And that's when, this point is why I find this so hilarious, in this particular book, this lovely book called the Tibetan Art of Parenting, Wisdom published it. These American mummies interviewed some Tibetan mummies about how they prepare to get to conceive and all that kind of business, how they get pregnant, you know. They do lots of prayers and practices. And incidentally, this is interesting, by the way. This is an interesting point, yeah. But they really, the Tibetan, the Buddhists, you know, they take it very seriously because you want to attract a good consciousness to your womb. I mean, okay, you don't mind if you give birth to a psycho. It'd be hard work being a mummy to a psycho, isn't it? But you want a nice baby. You want a good quality baby. That's reasonably. Well, the Buddhist view, because you know you didn't make the thing. You don't make it. You're just providing a womb for it. Then you want to attract a really good consciousness. Now that's really logical. You know, they say then you really got to have good, nice, virtuous sex. That doesn't mean you don't have fun. They don't say that in the book. I'm just being rude as usual. But you do lots of practices before. You do your purification. You do your mantras. You know, in general, and then you have your sex. And that means you're still going to have orgasms and nice fun. Of course, it's pleasure. But you're not being greedy. You're not going to be drunk. You're not going to be full of drugs. You're not going to be raping the person. You're not going to be like a vampire just sucking them up because you're greedy for sex, which is, of course, how we have sex in the West. We're so degenerate. And don't hear this in a moralistic sense. It's just our attachment has gone berserk. Well, think about it. If you're completely out of your brain on drugs, or raping somebody, or just greedily having sex with any old person, what kind of consciousness do you think is going to come to your womb? Excuse me. Why would a holy consciousness want to come to this messy people? And you're creating the cause. If you're acting like an animal, and I'm not being, hear me properly, if you're acting like some greedy animal, eating up the other person, you're going to attract a really disturbed, deluded human being. Are you not? Now why do we have poor children more and more deluded, more and more crazy, more and more suffering, more and more mental illnesses these days? Don't be surprised. But if you're going to have really, you know, you're going to be moral and do practice, then indeed be generous and compassionate and have blissful sex as a bonus, why not? Well, guess what kind of conscience you're going to attract? A decent one. Makes sense. Anyway, the point I want to quote from this book, this other point, I mentioned this before. One Lama was quoted as saying, at the time of a male and female having sex, this is hilarious, billions of consciousnesses that have recently passed away, and obviously it can't be from the human realm because there aren't that many, billions of consciousnesses that have recently passed away from the animals, from the spirits, from the hells, who knows, are all hovering about, desperate to get in. We got in. I think it's amazing. You're supposed to laugh. Not one of you laughed. That's meant to be fun. Isn't that funny? Isn't that outrageous? Isn't that ridiculous? Isn't that intense? I mean, you wouldn't teach it. Robbie wouldn't teach this to his patients when they're getting pregnant. Well, can you please tell me how to get pregnant? Your patient says, Robbie. Well, I want you to do some Tara practices and have really good virtuous sex, and be careful you attract the right sentient being from the intermediate state, dear. He wouldn't give that advice, would he? He'd give him a pill, wouldn't you? What would you do? What would you do, Robbie? How do you help people get pregnant, Robbie?
There are a lot of tests you can do.
There you go. Okay. Never mind. So if you go to Robbie, he can give you that advice. Okay. the best is yet to come here. You know, Freud would have loved this. So there I was in the intermediate state, hanging about, waiting for a new rebirth. I'm not quite sure where I was heading, but kind of desperate, a bit kind of grasping and frantic. And then all of a sudden, you know, on December 20, oh, that was when I was born. Oh yeah, May something, 7 months before December 20, on May, about say May 20, 1944, my mummy and daddy kind of got all turned on and hopped into bed, right? And then the egg and sperm came together, and I grabbed that opportunity, and so I ran like a magnet, my consciousness out of the intermediate state. You wait for this. Where is it? Okay, the experience of being reborn is similar to the experience of waking up, but whether we wake up in a pleasant day or a violent storm is another matter. Okay, so if from the intermediate state, in my case, in your case, you know, I'm going to take birth as a human. I will see my future, I saw mummy and daddy in sexual union. Like I have a vision of it. The karma ripens between you, you know? I always think of Romeo and Juliet, or I think of Tony and Maria in West Side Story. I bought it recently for my iPad. Now they're out the dance, you know? And all of a sudden, all the sharks and the jets, and suddenly Maria and Tony see each other, isn't it? And everything else disappears. That's karma ripening. Like you've got some history with each other, and they go, wow, that's how it is when you get seeing your mummy and daddy. All of a sudden, pow, karma ripens. If you're going to be born, okay, as a male, okay, I was born as a girl, so I was super attracted to my father. Like completely natural, spontaneously driven by intense attachment for my father. Because of the habit, the karmic imprint of attachment to sexual union, I would want to embrace and have sexual intercourse with my father. That made me become a girl. I went there like a magnet. That's what they say, you know? And that caused me to be intensely attracted. And that attached, because this is a desire realm for the Buddha. We can spend weeks just discussing this. The Buddhist description of how come we have these bodies with things and we join together called sex and all this business, you know? We've created this karma over eons. It's like karmic evolution. We created the cause to have bodies with, you know, bits that stick in things, other bits, and we have babies and that kind of business. This is our own due to powerful attachment over many eons of lives, Buddha says. That's created the cause to have these bodies, to have what we call sexual attachment, to have this, to all this stuff that we cause. It didn't come from God. It's not a mystery. The Buddha's got this. It's like karmic evolution. And because we are living in a desire realm, it's driven by attachment. And then the whole spectrum of all the desire realm, all these different realms of existence, are all in terms of whether you get what attachment wants or don't, from happiness to suffering. It's the reference point for all of them, all the experiences, you know? So my consciousness, due to karma, ran like a magnet. And then when I get to them in sexual union 1 second later, you get annoyed. Aversion arises because all you see is the sexual organs, and then you die from the intermediate state, and I rushed into the egg and sperm. That's the beginning of Rabina. What a way to get born. It's not some kind of holy thing. It is easy to see how ordinary birth is caused by karma and delusions, as Rinpoche puts it, finally. So that's a rough description of the death process and being reborn, okay? It's time for lunch, but a few questions before we have lunch. Any questions about that? Yes. Microphone, please.
So I have a question for all of the people around me who aren't the Buddhist, who I'd like to help.
But we're not discussing help yet. We're discussing the death process. Can we keep it on the death? It will all absolutely come, and I want it'll all come. It'll all come. That will come. But let's just discuss the death process now. If there's any questions about this.
Okay.
Do you have any questions about this yet? No.
It was about the dreams.
Okay, good. Ask the question.
So I have had conscious dreams, and I practice lucid dreaming.
Well, good.
Would it be useful to help other people to use their dreams?
So how do you see using it? How does it help you?
If you're more comfortable with your dreams.
But who cares?
Well,
you're still going to die. How's it going to help you die? How's it going to help you practice morality? If it's not going to help you do that, it's just having fun. It's nice. I'm glad for you. But what good is it?
I just thought that it would allow you to be more comfortable when your subtle consciousness becomes more powerful.
Oh, yeah, okay. Now you're getting somewhere. If we can learn to have more lucid, as you call it, lucid dreaming, which means have more control over your mind when you're dreaming, then absolutely perfect, perfect, totally perfect. Yes, exactly. Perfect.
Okay.
Perfect.
Thank you.
Exactly. Yep. Yes, darling. Anybody else? Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Thank you. You were talking about the person who witnessed someone who was terrified.
Yes.
And looked as if they were scared. Oh. When their karmic seed...
Well, they saw them looking like they were absolutely terrified, like seeing like hideous hallucinations of monsters and demons, yes.
Yes.
Yep. Then?
At that point, could a person who's witnessing that, I don't know if you can turn it around.
It's very hard. I'd say
them.
If... Now, what happened in this case to this person, they didn't in fact, the person did calm down, and then they died later peacefully. So maybe they purified something. But if that is the actual thing that's happening as they die and leave their body, it's a bit late. You can't do much then. But Rinpoche gives all these practices that could help later to help them shift direction. Yes.
I see. And so if you have the death atmosphere very peaceful and calm, perhaps you can continue what you're doing. And like you said...
You mean if they have all the visions? Now, the point here is about that. Is that indicates that already a very negative karmic scene has been triggered and already they're heading towards that realm. That's what that's saying. That's hard to change direction, but Rinpoche does give practice, which we'll talk about later, that can even possibly, depending on the karma of the person, help them shift direction. Yes.
I see. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, this is an extension of the question this gentleman has.
Which question?
This chapter.
About the dreams.
Okay.
About the dreams.
Yeah. So
what's the question?
As a scientist, I look into the theory and I create the prototype. So I was thinking about dream is a good opportunity to do experiment. So what you told the model building, you know, different color, moving the wind and all those things, is it, if I have a little bit at the beginning of the dream, can I create some type of prototype to do some analytical experiment on the death?
In your dream? I'm a bit confused. Start again. I didn't understand you. I'm so sorry. Could you please ask me in another way?
So I'm telling you that dream portion can be used using your model, different stages, color and different...
If one what?
Makes the death.
I really want to understand you, and forgive me, but I can't hear very well. So you please be patient with me and say it again in a different way. I want to understand you. I don't understand. That's my mistake.
So, it's a dream, okay?
So there you are dreaming.
Okay, when
okay,
I'm
good.
Dreaming
that's
at
your
the
subtle
beginning,
consciousness.
When I'm at the beginning of the dream.
What? It was at the beginning of the dream, yeah?
So my mind is a little bit aware of what is going on.
If it is aware, yeah, that's very marvelous. If it is, then?
Then... You have a theoretical model which you are telling.
You have a what? A theoretical model? Who does?
It means that you just describe about the stages of the death.
Oh, okay. Yeah, describing what happens. Yes, then?
And then basically, then I create the same stages you are talking about. You know, it's moving from one part of the body to the another and color is changing. Can I use that?
But you wouldn't in your dream, no, because that's the stage of the subtle consciousness. What you would do, how you'd train in this.
Yeah.
Like if you train doing a marathon, you have to know the map first. You have to know where you're going, uphill, downhill. Then you train your mind first, theoretically, you've got the map, haven't you? And then you start training doing it. Well, here you start training thinking it through in meditation. First this stage, now that stage. And you begin to become familiar even intellectually with it. Then if you're really advanced, you can start to train yourself when you go to sleep to attempt to be conscious at each stage. And then when you've got single-pointed concentration, especially using the tantric model, the great yogis, they can actually go through, be conscious going through these stages. So it's step by step. That's the point. Yes.
Thank
and then death is easy for you. Because you're familiar. Absolutely. Yes. Yes. This gentleman, first Robbie, just a second, please. Okay. Down the back. Yes, Robbie.
If our death is very sudden or violent,
yes.
Do we go through all the same stages
yes.
in the same order?
Yes. Like I said earlier, you mightn't have been here, but if you walk down 50 flights of stairs, or you fall down, you go through the same stages, but one's real quick. And therefore, of course, the only reason that's not cool is because you've got no chance to be in control, no chance to stay aware. That's the real problem with sudden death. That's why we really have to pray we don't die suddenly. You know? Exactly. Yes.
If you're falling down the stairs, then does that mean a negative karmic seed is ripening because you don't have the chance to...
Yeah, absolutely. Too late. Bad, difficult, isn't it? That's a trouble. That's why if you do, you are going to die suddenly. Hang on, keep the mic, please. John. Who's that?
Certainly. It's Peter.
It's Peter. Oh, there he is. So if you're going to die suddenly, and we can't say we won't, because when your gas tank of morality runs out, the breath will stop. The thing is, that's why if we are thinking it's likely or we could die suddenly, and we do, there's a certain percentage of people who do, that means you've got to be watching your mind. That's the reason you've got to watch your mind like a hawk every millisecond and only ever be virtuous and be terrified at the thought of dying when you have a moment of anger. If we really understood impermanence, that would turn us into the most blissful, virtuous people you could ever imagine. Wouldn't it?
Yes.
You see my point?
I do. Let me ask you a follow-up to that, though. If you die a violent death, is there a possibility...
Violent death.
A violent death.
Like someone kills you or a car crash.
Absolutely. Is it possible that you're burning off some major bad karma?
Well, of course it is. But honey, if you're going to go to another lower realm, who cares? Of course it is. And it is. Listen, Peter, just logically, if we take the analogy of seeds and fruits, every time a weed ripens, that's the end of that seed, isn't it? Isn't it?
Yes.
So logically, it's finished.
Right. Well,
the same here. But if it's going to happen at death, it's most inconvenient because it could very easily trigger a negative seed to another boring old lower realm. So thank you very much. We don't want that.
Thank you.
Do we? So up here, please. Yes. Microphone up here. Mm-hmm. Up here, Kim. Yes, wait, John, the microphone. Yes.
Hello. You know the Jataka story, Buddha's story of different existence.
Yes, past lives, yes.
Yeah. My question is, and also in India, because I'm from India.
Yes, yes.
We have that sort of
That's
story.
Right, exactly.
How, what is the mechanism or how they can remember?
Well, that's the point. That's the whole thing. What's your name?
Shama.
Shama, okay. Mr. Sharma, or is that your first name?
That is my first name, Sharma.
Okay, may I call you Sharma?
Yeah.
Thank you. Okay, so Sharma, your point, as I said before, remember I said that story about that girl who killed herself, but she had this vision of all her past experiences. The Buddha's point is this, the way mind works, everything any sentient being ever sees, hears, does, thinks about, leaves impressions in the mind. One Lama said it's almost like everything we do in our life, we're taking photos and we're storing the negatives. And the next life, we will then print those pictures out and that'll be our life. We're creating it. So everything we ever experience never goes astray. So it's all locked away there. So because we're living at this very gross consciousness level, we can't access our subtle mind. We can see ourselves that we, you know, even if you get up at 7 in the... Keep the mic, Sharma. Even you get up, if you get up at 6 in the morning, by 5 past 6, you've already forgotten 90% of what you thought. Because our gross consciousness is not capable of containing all the information, but it's all stored away. So as you progress and get meditation skills, you're going to be able to access your subtle consciousness, and that's where you can have memory. In dreams, you can see the past, you can see the future, and that's exactly what our capability is. And as you progress spiritually, and you rid your mind of all the rubbish and all the fears and all the ego, you're continuing to access more and more vividly, more past, more future, until eventually you're a Buddha, when literally then you can see everything that exists. That's just the nature of mind. It's its capacity. You see?
Yeah.
That's our nature. And that's where often Buddha would say we can't begin to help others until we have clairvoyance. Do you understand?
Yeah.
So a really nice story. We'll finish then, we'll have lunch. One of my friends, Harry, was at our monastery in Kathmandu. And there was some monk there who was quite sick, and he found a doctor to help the monk. Well, then Harry told told Lama Yeshe, our guru, his Lama's, you know, was Harry's guru. He mentioned to Lama that he'd found a doctor to help this monk. Well, Lama just said to Harry, leave it alone. Don't do anything. He didn't explain his reasons. So Harry has confidence in Lama, so he didn't do anything. So the monk got much sicker, then he went back up to the mountains, he was a Sherpa, and he died. So that sounds a bit shocking, like as if Lama Yeshe doesn't care, you know. But Lama, the abbot at the monastery explained to Harry, he said because of Lama's, you know, power, his own mind, and because of his clairvoyance, and clairvoyance, we think is some hippy-trippy thing in the West, you know. But for the Buddha, it's something that every mind has the capacity to access through all these practices. It's just natural. And so because of Lama's clairvoyance, he could see clearly the karma the monk had created, And as Lama put it, if he could have finished that, he could have got better this life by going to the doctor, his life would have been fine. But the karma was such a heavy one that his next life, it wouldn't have been finished, and his next life would be terrible. Whereas he, and this is Peter's point, he then died by getting sick and then dying, and in fact he died very well, very peacefully, had a very good death. He completely cleaned up that karma, next life fantastic. Now that's kind of shocking to us, and we think about helping people, all we can see is what we see in front of us, and we're default mode, keep them alive as long as possible, because that's called helping people. But we don't know, you know, we don't have enough wisdom. So the general idea in Buddhism is you've got to have both wings of the bird, wisdom and compassion. Well, compassion is the wish to help, but that doesn't give you the skill. That's wisdom, and this is the real wisdom of clairvoyance, seeing the mind of the person and even seeing the karma of the person, which is why we can't really begin to really help people until we have that wisdom, you know. So kind of way to go. Are we communicating here?
Yeah.
So I think it's time for lunch. Time, good. Time for lunch. So, please, the lunch time, how long should we take, do you think? How long will it take, do you think? Hour and a half, hour and a quarter?
No.
1, 2, 3, whatever you like. Be comfortable. What I'd love you to do is all have lunch together, blah, blah, gossip, talk about the weather, talk about Mr. Trump, but not too much. Try and stick to the, and then when you're ready, after you've eaten and said hello, then take one or more of the things we've discussed and talk in a small group. About it, unpack it, analyze it, question. That's really the most helpful to discuss. But if you don't want to talk, you want to be quiet, then okay, be quiet, don't talk. But if you're going to talk, talk about this stuff. That's what I'd like you to do. That makes it really useful. It makes lunch part of the deal, okay? Is that okay? And I'll see you very, very soon. Whenever you're ready, someone can come and tell me.